Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack.
And Sean Chapman.
We are here to talk about stuff this week on the show. Busy, busy week.
So much stuff.
We pushed it to Tuesday so we could talk about the glorious return of Twin Peaks.
Yes.
Quick reaction.
Holy shit.
Yeah, that's mine too.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to talk about that in depth. That'll be at the end of the podcast. If you haven't seen it, make sure you also watch the two that they put up online. We're going to talk about the first 4 hours of the return. And then, assumedly, when episodes start airing again in 2 weeks, we'll get to back to it then.
Yeah.
But just watch that stuff. I'm not going to say a goddamn more word about it. You need to go in as clean as possible.
Yeah.
It's a glorious experience.
And just, again, make sure you watch all 4 of the episodes that are available to you, which are only available on, like, their online service or whatever.
Right.
Because they are necessary viewing, and we are not going to be able to separate the discussions for, like, the first 2 episodes and the next 2 episodes, because it is all one giant web.
Of glorious David Lynch.
Yes.
All right, so we've got that. We're going to talk about this week's episode of Doctor Who, Extremis.
Yes.
Also holy shit.
Yeah, it was a very holy shit kind of week in a lot of ways.
That was like one of the most Lynchian episodes of Doctor Who ever.
Yeah.
Glorious coincidence, it aired this weekend.
Yeah.
So we have that. I'm going to talk about the new Fire Emblem game, Fire Emblem Echoes Shadows of Valentia. It's really good.
Good job remembering that whole title.
Yeah, I've got it written down.
Okay, oh, there we go.
No, it's okay. I do, you know, see it a lot when I'm restarting because the battles are difficult.
Okay, yes. Because it's one of, that's like the remake of the old Fire Emblem, so it's one of those that kicks your ass.
It kicks your ass. It's surprisingly easy for like the first 7-8 hours and lulls you into a sense of like, should I have done a different difficulty at the start? And then it's like, fuck you! And it's wonderful. Good. No, great game. Gonna talk about that. We're gonna talk about some other random things, but Sean... Yes. What stuff have you been up to?
Honestly, not a huge amount of stuff, like, of any note. I have my life has still been weirdly affected by finishing that Romance of the Three Kingdoms TV show. Like, it keeps sitting with me in a way that, like, I really wasn't expecting going into watching that show to be coming out the other side, like, 2 weeks later and, like, weirdly depressed about, like, oh, right, man, oh, that was, all that stuff was sad. And so that has kind of still been happening. And other than that, I'm still sort of like working my way through Dragon Quest III and having fun with that. And another thing I've been doing is after the big Twin Peaks podcast that we did last week, I decided it was time to get around to watching some other David Lynch stuff.
Nice.
And so I finally watched Mulholland Drive for the first time. I did that the day after we recorded that podcast because it's on Netflix, so people can just see it. Yeah, that's one of the...
It's gone off and on.
Yeah, so. It's one of the great things about Netflix. I feel like the way their service has changed in the last couple of years, it doesn't happen to me that much, but it's how I've gained a lot of my like movie watching experience in high school was just like thinking about like, oh yeah, I've heard about that movie. I wonder if it's on Netflix. And if it is, you're just like, oh, I can just watch that right now. It was so much more convenient than having to like plan to go like, I'm going to go to the video store tomorrow and see if the video store has The Godfather or something. And it was so much harder to watch movies that way.
Yeah.
Whereas if it's just on Netflix, you're like, oh yeah, Jonathan was talking about how much he liked Mulholland Drive on that podcast. I should watch it. And then I watched it. That is it. That is probably the best David Lynch thing I've seen.
I go there with that one.
Yeah, it's really unbelievably good.
It is. It's fucking funny. It is such a funny.
It is extremely funny.
It's also so tender and heartfelt.
Yeah.
It has so many layers of intelligence and pathos to it. Mm-hmm. And I think it also might be kind of the perfect blend of him pushing to the avant-garde just enough while still having like slight narrative tentacles. It's not a complete avant-garde film like Inland Empire, which I watched this week.
I have that one sort of set up that I think I'm going to watch that tonight or tomorrow night.
Here's my Inland Empire story. I love that movie. It is a 100% avant-garde film.
Great.
It's a 3-hour avant-garde movie, and I say that I went to the avant-garde film school. I know what's what with that. It is just an avant-garde movie with Laura Dern and Jeremy Irons and stuff, which is awesome. You know, it was shot on camcorders from the year 2006, and it looks like shit, which is great. And it's also got segments of the movie in Polish because he got Polish financing for that film.
Great.
And I did not know that going in, and I also did not know there were going to be subtitles. So early on in the movie, there's brief things with the Polish characters, and I'm like, okay, well, there's a lot of like dialogue you intentionally can't hear in this movie, so I assume the foreign language, like he just doesn't want us to know what that is.
Right, yeah.
And then there started getting longer and longer scenes with the Polish people, and there were no subtitles, and I'm like, this could just be Lynch.
Yeah.
That would not be unexpected, but it got to a point where it's like, there's been 5 minutes of Polish, and I'm like, okay, I got to look this up. And I looked it up in the version I... Because that's a really hard film to find. Mm-hmm. The version I had just had no subtitles with it. There are supposed to be subtitles with that movie. Make sure the version you have has that. I actually don't know if it impacts the viewing at all, really. I don't think it would make more sense with the subtitles.
But at least you're not going to be sitting there distracted by, like, not knowing whether or not it would have changed how you'd interpret the scene.
That's exactly it. But that's a great movie, too. But Mulholland Drive, getting back to that.
Yeah.
Naomi Watts... That's one of the best performances in any Lynch movie.
Yeah.
But also Laura Herring and everyone just...
Yeah, it's just an incredible movie across the board. I think what struck me the most about it was the... You know, because we talked a lot about on the David Lynch sort of Twin Peaks podcast about how, you know, he blends dream and reality, and that's a big interest of his. And you talked a little bit about how Mulholland Drive does that on that podcast. But obviously, that was like right before I had seen the movie. And for me, like, Mulholland Drive is just... absolutely the most accomplished version of trying to sort of like interpret and represent dream logic in a movie I've ever seen. Like it is absurd how on point he is, particularly when you get to the sort of like the last phase of the movie or however you want to sort of like think of how it's structured, that like the very specific details in what is manipulated and how sort of orders of like the chronology or order of events is presented to you and is sort of distorted is so immaculate to like my experience of like having those like weird muddled weirdly sort of like detailed narrative dreams that you get like every like once in a while. It's so perfect.
It is literally a movie that helps you understand your own humanity more because of how well it encapsulates that experience of dreaming, I think. And it's why I find the discussions of like what does all this represent online so funny with that. It doesn't annoy me. I just find it funny with that movie because it's like that's not the point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I sort of did what you recommended and checked out the Wikipedia article after I saw the movie. And man, that Wikipedia article is something.
It's something.
It is crazy.
But no, I mean, Mulholland Drive feels like going to sleep and waking up 3 hours later. And I think you can, after, you know, several viewings of that movie, you probably have as much of a sense of exactly what happened as you do with a good, like a very vivid dream.
Yeah.
In that you know things that happened, you don't always know their placement or how they relate to each other. That movie has whole non sequitur sequences, you know, that probably would have meant something if it had been the TV series it was planned to be.
Right, yeah.
But like it being a movie was such a perfect way for that movie to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. God, I love that movie.
Yeah, it's really just utterly phenomenal.
Yeah. And there's some consensus starting to grow around like what are the best films of this century so far. And I feel like that is one of the two or three that's always at the top of the list. And I find it kind of amazing that Lynch was able to make a movie that weird that spoke to like that kind of critical, you know, consensus.
Yeah.
Which he did, you know, maybe with like a Blue Velvet back in the day, although it took some time for that. But Blue Velvet is nowhere near as weird as...
No, yeah.
And it's a weird-ass movie, so...
Because I feel like Mulholland Drive is a movie that like... a different or lesser director would have ended that movie with like a shot of like if it like think if like David Lynch was made a worse version of that movie, I would imagine he like the movie would end with a shot of him, David Lynch himself, waking up in bed, and then it would smash to black to like make it clear this movie's just a fucking dream. Like this whole thing, however you want to fucking spin it, it is a dream, and not giving into ever making that like explicitly clear, I think is a really bold choice, and it speaks so much to the quality of the filmmaking that, like, you don't need to make that explicitly clear at any point in the movie.
Yeah. I've actually been filling out my David Lynch DVD collection, because there's still one or two I haven't seen and that I didn't own, and goddamn Elephant Man is out of print, and that's sad. Is it?
That sucks.
But anyway, I've been getting most of the other ones. Like, the two I don't have are Elephant Man and Inland Empire, because those are both long out of print.
Yeah, so, like, Criterion hasn't picked up those?
No, not that we know of. Like, they do have an ongoing relationship with Lynch. Their Mulholland Drive set is one of my favorites. Same with Eraserhead. Those are phenomenal. I would imagine they'll have another one at some point. It's just kind of trying to figure out, like, Blue Velvet has a Blu-ray release from Fox. I don't think they're going to do that.
Right.
They're obviously not going to do Dune. Although that would be an amazing Criterion collection.
Criterion would put out an amazing version of Dune. Holy shit.
They absolutely would. It's just not going to happen.
That would be like an unbelievable day one purchase for me. Like, yes. Right away.
They're probably not going to get the straight story because that is a Disney movie. I completely forgot that that movie just opens with the Disney logo. And the DVD is it says on the spine, Disney DVD, which is it's amazing to have a Lynch DVD that says Disney DVD on the side.
Yeah, jeez.
But I think like... Wild at Heart had a Twilight Time Blu-ray that was limited to 3,000 and sold out immediately. Maybe that. I think, honestly, Inland Empire would be a better candidate because Lynch owns the rights. It has no good like release here. There's no way you can make that movie look good because of how it was. And I mean like conventionally good.
Right, right.
But I think they could get a Blu-ray or a DVD out that like is the best representation of it with everything you want. And, you know, so I think... Hopefully there's more. It's Mulholland Drive was 2 years ago now, and I'm sure, you know, Lynch would like to work with him and get some of his movies out in good quality, but, you know.
Yeah.
So, anything else?
No, not really. That about does it for me.
Awesome. Well, I'll talk about some movies.
Okay.
I went to see Alien Covenant.
Right.
You might see it at some point.
Yeah, I'll probably try to see it this week so we can talk about it on the podcast. Yeah.
So we might talk about it at some point. I'm going to talk about that movie less, but I'll talk about it in a little bit. One, because my thoughts on it are still cohering, and two, because I also spent the last week binging the entire Alien series.
Yes, which is interesting because now our Alien dynamic on this podcast has totally changed. It used to be I had seen two more Alien movies than you. You have now seen three more Alien movies than I've seen because I've never seen Alien 3 or 4.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. Well, let me talk about these really quick.
Yeah.
I got the Alien Anthology box set. I'm like, I'm going to finally watch these. Never seen these. It's like a hole in my film viewing knowledge. But it's also kind of fun when you've waited on some of these, and it's like, I get to experience this for the first time.
Right, yeah, that's how kind of I felt about Mulholland Drive.
Yeah.
Just like I had seen, you know, Eraserhead, I had seen Blue Velvet, I'd seen Elephant Man, I'd seen Dune, I'd seen Twin Peaks, and I was like, Mulholland Drive felt like that was the big one that I just never got around to, and then like being like, okay, yeah, now I can get back into this.
Yeah. But anyway, so I watched them all, like, I actually watched Alien and Aliens on the same day, and then I tried the same thing with Alien 3 and 4, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. Because I've technically only seen 2.5 more movies than you
have. Oh, okay.
So you can guess which one that is. But anyway, so Alien 1, I'll do quick reviews of each movie.
Yes.
Alien 1 is a fucking masterpiece.
Yes, it is. It's easily one of the best, if maybe not the best, like, American horror movie ever made.
Yes, I would probably agree with that. It is... I think the maybe one of the most formally daring Hollywood studio films ever made. Mm-hmm. Especially, you know, the blockbuster category was a very different thing in 1979, still in its nascent stages. But that movie plays to... It's so weird that that movie spawned a franchise.
Yeah, right?
Because that movie plays to me like a 70s auteur movie, you know, in the style of your Godfather and Network and things like that, and all the Martin Scorsese films, you know, Raging Bull and Taxi Driver. It just so happens to be set in space and be about an alien. So it kind of, it's, you know, it exists in the same area as like John Carpenter's Halloween and all that stuff. But also I think in that other area where it is just a cinematic vision, not like a you know, big studio blockbuster first.
Yeah.
It, you know, we're talking about Dreams with Mulholland Drive. Honestly, another movie I would put up in that category is the first Alien. It plays to me like a 2-hour nightmare sequence. You know, I would say dream sequence, but it's pretty scary.
Yeah.
So we'll call it a nightmare sequence. But like it does, like it has, it is so slow. It is so careful with the images it builds. So many of the images are of, you know, theoretically normal space things, like a corridor, but it's all kind of off kilter. It's got a very like minor surrealist twinge to how it's made. I just think it's beautiful. And also, like, that the script for that movie could not be more than, like, 30 pages.
Right, yeah.
And it's an amazing... And I even was reading about this, that they even wrote the script, like, every role in it was unisex. And they said, whoever, like, makes this movie, just cast whatever genders you want. It literally doesn't matter. And that's actually something that kind of pisses me off about Aliens and some other movies, is how much they try to be like, get it, Ripley's a girl! And
right,
it's like,
yeah,
okay, that wasn't important to the first movie, but whatever. Anyway, but, like... There's so many things about that movie that are so minimalistic and interesting to me, and then it's all just Ridley Scott's direction, and it's amazing. That's the second movie he made. That's the second movie he ever directed. Blade Runner is the third. That dude peaked really early. And I don't want to, like... I'm not saying that to say he's a bad director later on. It's just that Alien and Blade Runner have this experimental avant-garde flavor around the fringes. They are not experimental films, but they have that kind of flavor to them, and they are so out on a limb in so many formal and stylistic ways, and I love them both to death. And one of my frustrations with Alien Covenant is you can feel it. He is trying to tap back into that, and I think he is just such a fundamentally different filmmaker than he was back then. Like, he can't block out the more commercial instincts anymore.
Right.
And, you know, for a number of reasons. And I would love to see him be able to tap back into that in full. But I think it's just that guy is gone. And that's no one's fault. And I'm not saying he's a bad director for it. But it's just, there's just this unbelievable quality about Alien where it, we'll say this about Twin Peaks later too, it feels very short and also like a lifetime long.
Yeah.
By the time you come out the other side of that movie.
Yeah. Something that like always strikes me is really remarkable about Alien, particularly for horror movies, is that I feel like horror movies age in like really particular ways that they lose. They tend to lose a lot of their impact as time goes on, even if, you know, like a movie like Psycho is still a really great, effective movie, but it's not shocking the way it was in 1960. But Alien, I feel like, has not aged that way. Like, I feel like Alien is a horror movie. You could release Alien fucking yesterday. And obviously, other than, like, the very specific elements that date it to the late 70s, you could, like, it would totally pass muster. Like, the scene where, like, John Hurt has to go out and go investigate the spaceship and find the alien eggs, like, and, like, the, you know, the storm is going on and the communications are cutting out and everything. Like, that sequence is filmed in such a way that, again, like, you could just... It's as, like, sort of edgy and modern as any horror movie in terms of, like, the experience, the visceral experience of watching it.
The only thing is I think it would be released in art house theaters.
Sure,
I don't, like, and just compare it to Alien Covenant and how much more aggressive that movie just kind of has to be with its pace. Just movies aren't made like that anymore. They frankly were never made quite like that in that genre. It's fascinating. So Alien is A+.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
It's the only Alien movie I really care about. So, and I feel
okay,
sick.
Yes, weird.
Aliens.
Yes.
I tweeted this, and it's kind of my only reaction. That is a fantastic 90-minute action movie in the body of an incredibly overlong 154-minute action movie that feels roughly 7 hours long at points.
Yes.
That is, I know, I honestly, I'm going to get shit for this.
Uh-huh.
That is maybe the most poorly paced James Cameron movie, and I think that's saying something, because the dude is not good with pace.
Yeah.
You know, Titanic and Avatar are both like 3 hours long and shit. Both of those go by faster to me than Aliens. Aliens, like, you don't see an alien for like 90 minutes in that movie. Yeah. The last hour is the thing people talk about with Aliens, and like people love about that movie, and it is a really good last hour. There's like 90 minutes before you get there, and this is not Alien, where it's like very artistically interesting, and I feel like they're really carefully building tension. It's just really bad acting of like space marines doing really just awful performances, other than Bill Paxton, who's fucking fun in that movie. I don't know, like, Aliens is interesting. It should not be watched in the same day as Alien, because they are vastly different movies.
Yes, yeah.
And that's like, that's one of the things, is that James Cameron also is a talented director in a lot of ways. His movies are generally not all that visually interesting to me. I would maybe make an exception for Titanic, and Avatar is for totally different reasons. Nothing really to do with cinematography there, I think, right. Just the effects. But like Aliens is very flat in how it looks. It's much more kind of brightly lit than Alien. There's nothing that kind of feels like it's challenging you visually. I'm not saying it has to do those things, but it's just back to back. It's kind of, especially because it is such a much longer movie than Alien. Alien is sub 2 hours.
Yes.
And Aliens is 2.5 if you're watching the special edition, which is kind of the only one you can watch, because otherwise, from what I understand of what they cut, Ripley's motivations make no sense.
Yeah, they basically cut like they don't completely cut it out, but they flatten out the thematic sort of core of that movie with like the motherhood themes, which is what that movie is about to me.
Yeah, also Newt is a fucking annoying character, and I don't like that side of the movie. It also is just like, she's a female action hero, so she's gonna be a mother in this movie. That just struck me as the, and I know so much of this is because I'm coming to Aliens in 2017.
Yeah, yeah.
But, like, that struck me as the most obvious way you could do that. And probably some of that is because a million movies have ripped off Aliens.
Yes.
And that's the other thing that makes that movie difficult to watch now, is it has, more than maybe any other American movie I've ever seen, it is so strip-mined by pop culture. There's, like, no moment of that movie that has not been taken by something else.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you joked on Twitter, it's like every sci-fi game from the 90s and 2000s just wrote their scripts by drawing lines from Aliens out of a hat.
Yeah, I mean, like, literally, I can name at least, like, StarCraft and Halo, for sure.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
The first Halo have at least a dozen lines each that are literally just quote-for-quote lines from Aliens. I mean, the entire, like, Terran dropship unit from StarCraft, her lines are just Aliens lines, and it's ridiculous.
Yeah, Sergeant Johnson is just a character from Aliens.
Yes, exactly, you're right. He's a pawn from Aliens.
But no, I mean, look, there's a lot of really good things about Aliens. It's just, that movie has a reputation that I think outstrips what the movie itself is.
Yeah, I mean, it's something where, for me, my favorite part of Aliens, and I think the thing, honestly, that, like, endures about Aliens is, like, the production design. Like,
it's great.
The pulse rifle of Aliens is better than the movie Aliens to me.
Yes. No, I mean, it's what James Cameron always does well, and it's why I wish he kind of pushed himself more visually sometimes,
mm-hmm.
because always his production design elements are top notch.
Yeah.
But there's, I don't know if there's anything interesting always about how they're kind of shot and put together. But, you know, it's again, the climax of that movie is fantastic, and it just keeps building and building. Yeah.
Although, like, I actually, the climax of the movie is the kind of the area I have some of the biggest issues with, of that, like, it just feels like the movie climaxes and then just has to keep going and going and going. There are, like, so many steps that need to be made to finish the movie after Ripley has met the alien queen.
Yeah.
And, like, the movie should, like, wrap up relatively quickly after that scene, I feel, based on, like, how long it is and the pacing. And you have to go through so much stuff of going back and get up on the ship, and the alien queen falls, and you get into the power suit, and you have to fight the aliens. It's just like, Jesus fucking Christ, like...
Yeah.
It's something where I just feel the screenplay of Aliens has to do so much moving things around without a lot of narrative momentum or work.
That's my problem
that
with
it accomplishes.
That's my problem with the beginning of that movie is, like, if I were writing that film, Ripley would be woken up by travelers heading back to the moon, and she would just get taken there, and you would cut 30 minutes out of her going back to Earth and doing all this stuff and then talking to the people and then being mad at her, and she's like, no, I'm not going to go with you. And then you have to turn like, okay, I am going to go with you, and now we're going to go back there. And it's just like, it's forever. The first act of that movie is like 80 minutes long.
Yeah.
Anyway, but...
Or they should have just gone the other direction and like never had aliens at all in the movie and just made the entire movie just about Ripley having to come to terms with like living 200 years after she was cryogenically frozen and her daughter having died, and just deal with the fallout of all that shit.
Yeah, so... You know, hey, there's so much good stuff about it. I don't want to be too negative. Bill Paxton, who, you know, the late Bill Paxton now, is so much fun in that movie. And I think he's the one who, I tweeted this also, James Cameron is terrible at writing dialogue, and Bill Paxton knew that and knew the only way you can make it sound good is to be more over the top than Cameron is, and he's great.
Yeah.
Sigourney Weaver is such an amazing star. She's so great in that. There's so many, you know, fun things about it. I totally understand why people like that movie. It annoys me a little bit because I think it's the thing that made Alien a franchise.
Yes.
And not just an interesting movie.
I mean, Aliens is the movie that they made action figures about, right? Like, it's the same way with Terminator 1 and Terminator 2. Like, Terminator 2 is the one where, like, you get the fucking, like, toys out of your Happy Meal from Terminator 2, not from Terminator 1.
Alien 3, I'm actually on the other end of a little bit. I think it's better than it maybe gets credit for.
Sure, yeah.
It has a really interesting setup. It's incredibly fatalistic, like the most nihilistic, fatalistic, like big studio release I think I've ever seen, where it literally just opens with them, the ship from Aliens crashes, and the little girl is murdered, or is killed in the crash, and so is the Michael Biehn character, and they have to immediately do an autopsy on the little girl, and you see like her chest getting opened and stuff like that. Like, it is so ridiculously dark that, one, I understand why people hate it, because that is if you were attached to those characters, that's a horrible way to do
a sequel.
Yeah, if
you're someone who, like, grew up with and really adored Aliens, killing off all the characters that survived at the end of Aliens is not a good way to sort of, like, make a first impression.
Yeah, but other than, you know, if you can remove yourself from that, it's, you know, Ripley has landed on this planet, she is fatalistic because of this, it's a prison planet for just dudes, like, they don't let women on it. It's all, these guys are going to be there forever. They've kind of like found religion to kind of, gloss over the horrible darkness of their lives. It's an interesting setup. And then an alien gets loose, and it's kind of a typical alien thing. But with this kind of extra layer of just grimness that I find interesting, there's some really good acting and character work. Charles Dance, who you would know from Game of Thrones, he plays Tywin Lannister, is so good in that movie, even though they kill him way too early. He like is kind of the first to die, which is weird because he's the only other major character in the movie. So, but like any of them, of course, has the famous ending where Ripley just fucking kills herself. It's like, it's kind of, I like the audacity of the movie. It does not work as a film overall, but I like the audacity. David Fincher, I think, is a, you know, visually a much more interesting director than James Cameron. And even that, I think that was like his first movie. You get a lot of that in there. It's an interesting film. It's not a great film. I actually enjoyed watching it, though. It's sub 2 hours long, so I appreciated that.
There we go.
You know, although there's a extended cut that's 2 hours and 40 or something. But, you know, I didn't watch that.
Right.
Anyway, you know, it's okay. You know what it felt like to me, honestly, in the early going was like an episode of Doctor Who or Star Trek, where, like, Ripley lands on a planet, and she has to kind of figure out the circumstance. But, you know, at the end, she doesn't get away. But it does have kind of that Star Trek, Doctor Who kind of sci-fi serial quality to it, and I like that about it.
Cool.
Alien Resurrection, I turned off halfway through.
Okay.
It is so bad. Like, it is the cliche of how bad 90s action movies are. Because we've talked before on this podcast, there is no more reliably bad set of movies than mid to late 90s Hollywood blockbusters.
Yeah.
They are horrible. They are the worst movies ever made. They're just so bad. If you like Independence Day, I'm judging you. It's just, I hate these movies.
Yeah.
And Independence Day is like the best of them.
Exactly, yes. Which, that is a brand on that whole, like, era of filmmaking. Yeah. That Independence Day is like the standout.
They're ugly. The effects are bad. The writing is bad. No one knew what they were doing with tone. The acting is bad. It's just all awful. This one was directed by Jean-Pierre Jeunet, who you would know for directing the movie Amelie. Clearly great, you know, resume for a fucking alien movie. Yeah. The movie Amelie. He might have directed Amelie later, but my point still stands.
Right.
It's like, he has no idea how to do the tone of that movie. It's basically a slapstick comedy at points. And what's sad is it has an interesting premise, I think, of them, like, cloning Ripley to get the alien. And it's almost like, you could turn that into a great feminist subtext of the entire Alien series. Is a bunch of men dying because they won't listen to the smart woman in the room. And then when she kills herself to get away from them, they bring her back just to keep mansplaining to her. I find that kind of interesting. Sigourney Weaver is totally game in that movie, but it's so bad. And like once it just became like, oh, there's aliens, and they're, okay, they killed that guy, Ripley's doing, okay, I'm done. I know what the rest of this movie is. And yeah, that's a bad movie.
Okay, how's the fifth Alien movie?
Prometheus?
Yeah, I don't remember if I watched it or not. I don't think we've talked about it.
Interesting movie, not necessarily a good one.
Okay.
Is that a good, fair way to say it?
How, now that you have seen more Alien movies than I have, where does Prometheus fit in the hierarchy?
Well, let me talk about Alien Covenant.
Okay.
Alien Covenant is an interesting movie, and if you have any interest in these films or Ridley Scott's direction, I would recommend seeing it. I think it is both a better movie than Prometheus in that moment to moment, I think it's more enjoyable and doesn't have as much of the baggage Prometheus kind of took on.
Right.
But I also think it's a less cohesive movie. Like if at the end of Alien Covenant, like it's a couple different movies in one and kind of just goes until it stops. It's got five different climaxes. Like you were talking about the thing with aliens at the end. Right. So you ain't seen nothing yet. Alien Covenant ends like five different times. It's like if Return of the King were a sci-fi alien movie, but not good. As good. Because I did like this movie. But so it's not cohesive really at all. And yet, like moment to moment, it is so well made. So well made. Like, there are some shots in this movie. There's one early on where these solar, like, sails are unfurling on this ship. Amazing, amazing shot that only Ridley Scott could do. Some of the stuff on the planet they arrive at, where they meet the android David from the Prometheus movie, and he has this, like, whole kingdom of the dead he's created. It is one of the best sets in a sci-fi movie ever. It is a great just realization of a place, and you can just feel Ridley Scott having fun with the staging of things at some point. Like the moment where, you know, you get your first kind of alien bursting out of someone, that kind of scene should not be surprising anymore. And it's not surprising that it happens, but the way it happens is so much more gruesome and like brutal than you've seen in another alien movie. And like the way, the immediacy with which Scott directs it is absolutely visceral and fascinating. So there's so many things like that where I just think moment to moment, I love the direction. I love Scott allows himself to just be weird sometimes. Like, there's this whole thing. Michael Fassbender plays two characters. He plays David and then a new android who's got, like, the same look.
David 2.
David 2. Walter.
Oh.
Which...
That's confusing. I thought they would just be the David line of androids.
Yeah. No, David and Walter, which is weird because that's my father and my grandfather, respectively.
Well, there you go. I mean, the next one's going to be Jonathan. What's going to happen then?
I don't know. But, like, there are some scenes between the two of them. Like, I just wish Ridley Scott would make, like, a stage drama with Michael Fassbender acting opposite himself.
Or, like, do the, like, old, you know, like, move, like, kind of like comedy movie where just he plays every single character in, like, different makeup and everything.
No, I mean, there's one scene where he's teaching Walter how to play the flute. It's an amazing sequence. Like, it is Blade Runner worthy of, like, this askew view of humanity. And there are things like that that are amazing. I mean, he makes Michael Fassbender make out with himself. They're like,
okay, now I get why there's like a huge defense force among this movie from some people.
There are really interesting things, and I think if you look at like his best movies, Alien and Blade Runner, sometimes things are just weird in those movies because that's how they are.
Yeah.
And I like that quality to him. And yet at the same time, Alien Covenant is also wanting to be a bombastic action film. I don't think it's scary. It's not really a horror film. Even though I think it has all the ingredients to be a good horror film, it has some really interesting themes in that, like, the characters in this film are colonists, and they're going to, like, live on a new planet.
Right.
And so everyone in the crew are, like, each other's husbands and wives. And so there's things like when people die, it's not like, oh, this is the dude on my mining team. It's like, that was my husband or something. And there's things like that that are themes that, like, are so rich and interesting. They don't go far enough with. There's some follow-up on the themes of Prometheus that I think are better done here. But then there's, like, 500 other things going on. And I don't know. It's a really interesting film. I think it has interesting things it's trying to say. As with Prometheus, I'm not sure how often it really lands those things. But, you know, Scott is clearly very energized making these movies. Like, we thought that about Prometheus, too.
Right, yeah.
And this is very much, this movie is Prometheus 2. It is not an Alien, it's a Prometheus sequel, more than it is, I think, an Alien movie.
Yeah, the Alien part of it was not, probably not really Scott's, like,
no.
Ardent, like, decision, like, we need to put Alien back on the title. It was probably the studio being, you need to put Alien in the fucking title.
Yeah, but anyway, it's an interesting movie, and getting back to what you said about where do I rank these things?
Yes.
Again, Alien 1 is the only one I feel is, like, an essential piece of filmmaking.
Yeah.
Aliens is a better movie probably than Prometheus and Alien Covenant.
Okay.
I find Prometheus and Alien Covenant far more engaging and interesting as films, even when I hate them. And there are parts of Prometheus I cannot stand.
Yes.
But I also think that movie asks you to think things and demands things aesthetically and thematically that I find interesting and that are rare now that were rare back when these movies were starting to get made in terms of mainstream Hollywood filmmaking. And I do find that valuable, even if, you know, the conversations lead to sometimes maybe infuriation on our parts or something. I do think there's value in that. And so Sure. Some of me, like, I'm definitely more engaged with the Ridley Scott side of this whole thing. Even if, again, I would love for him to have made, like, one movie about the David android. Because that's the thing, is that this is more about David, and it ends with a setup for a third movie with more about David. And it's like, yes, that is a fascinating character. It's a phenomenal performance by Michael Fassbender. I wish you had just made a movie not connected to Alien, kind of about that guy, and, like, one solid movie that told the whole story. Because if you take all those pieces and put them together, all of that stuff is great. But, you know, it's split across two movies with a lot of different moving parts. I'll say one other thing. The acting is better in Alien Covenant. That is,
Okay. Other
than Michael Fassbender, the acting in Prometheus was pretty terrible.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the actor's faults. Like, that movie has a lot of good actors in it, but, like...
But, yeah, just, like, the script made all the characters. It's, like, Yeah. That classic bad horror movie thing of making every single character unbelievably incompetent, and there's Yeah. No way for an actor to make that character likable.
No. I thought the acting in this was much better. Catherine Waterston plays, like, the main female lead, and I love Catherine Waterston, and she's great. Danny McBride shows up, and I didn't expect to like that character at first. Like, he's playing a pilot named Tennessee. It works. Like, I could oddly, if this movie were modulated in tone more like Alien, I think he could fit even more, almost like Harry Dean Stanton does in the original Alien.
Okay, yeah.
But, you know, there's good work. The Billy Crudup is in this. He's very good, although there's a weird thing with his character where apparently he's, like, a devout Christian. And they never, like, establish that. It's just like, you're a devout Christian, so and it's like, but you never did anything with that. It's like the most out-of-left-field theme I've seen in one of these movies.
Okay, yeah.
Including all the out-of-left-field themes of Prometheus.
Yeah, Prometheus is a movie that is out-of-left-field themes. And you're just like, cut all that shit out and focus on the shit you want to. Like, pick something to make a movie about.
Yeah. But anyway, those are some Alien thoughts.
Okay.
Let's talk about some news.
Okay, what's going on in the news, Jonathan?
I want to start with something sad.
Yeah.
And this is just something I want to mention. This broke earlier today while we were prepping the podcast. Zack Snyder has left the Justice League movie.
In
post-production. This happened actually back in March. It's just being reported now. It was reported through The Hollywood Reporter, probably because they had a sense this was going to leak or something.
Yeah.
It sounds like they did not want this to get out there, but it did. And he left back in March because his daughter committed suicide. Horrible tragedy for that family. You know, we do not have to always like this guy's movies.
No.
To think that. And, you know, I know everyone says Zack Snyder is a good dude. And he and his wife, Deborah Snyder, who's his, you know, producing partner, they are clearly family people, first and foremost. And that just, you know, makes it all the sadder to think about. And, the details are, you know, that story, I think, was clearly Snyder and Warner Brothers trying to get ahead of whatever that story might be.
Yeah.
And not let it get paparazzied or anything. So what's happening with that film is he's been off the film. It sounds like he will not really be involved with finishing it. Joss Whedon was brought in to shoot the reshoots and direct some additional scenes and then see the movie through post-production. I guess he and Snyder have... I thought I read that in the story that, you know, he contacted Whedon, and it sounds like this was a mutual thing between the two of them. Does explain the story we got earlier this year of Whedon kind of working with DC.
Yeah.
It sounds like this might have been the in that he's helping to kind of get this movie over the finish line. Although I think if they hadn't have had to like come out with this, I'm pretty sure we would never have heard of his involvement.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing directors do, is they probably would have kept it on the down low. But yeah, I mean, that's horribly sad. Wish that family the best.
Absolutely.
It's just a bummer.
Yeah, no, it's just one of those things that it's one of those things where you're so used to just like the normal sort of like vapid Hollywood like movie news cycle, and then the story like that hits, and it's just like you almost don't even know how to process it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, because we usually talk about Snyder and directors like this in the context of the silly superhero movies they make.
Yeah.
And that's the context we would all like to talk about it, whether we like it or not. And, you know, that's just horribly, horribly sad. And I, you know, it sounds like Warner Brothers is giving him all the time and support he and his family need, which is great.
Yeah.
You know, that is a company that is very loyal to its people, which can be to the detriment of creative things sometimes. But it's nice to hear that they weren't, you know, inhumane about this or anything.
Yeah.
And yeah, just wish them the best. And that's a horrible thing to hear about.
Yeah.
And for them to go through primarily, obviously.
Yeah.
So that's one piece of news. Let's levy that with just some stupid news.
Okay, what's something stupid that's happening right now?
All right. I saw in like an email from a publicist today something about a dark universe. Mm-hmm. And I read like a sentence and I said, nope, this is too dumb. I'm not reading this. You apparently did read it. What's going on with this, Sean?
So, first of all, we have to get something straight because I've seen, you know, I follow a lot of like comic book people and video game people, movie people. There's a lot of nerdy people on Twitter, and I've seen a certain amount of confusion that I had at first when I saw the term dark universe being thrown around movie related, because DC has been working on, or DC, like Warner Brothers DC, has been working on pre-production kind of stuff for a Justice League Dark movie that they've been talking about for a couple of years now. And it would be theoretically titled Dark Universe is kind of like how they've been referring to it. That is not what we're talking about right now. That is something totally different. It's really weird that like both of those, like literally if you try to Google, like this morning when I was trying to Google about this story to sort of like see what it was about, like half the fucking Google search results on the first page were talking about the DC movie. Half of them were talking about the new thing, which is Universal Studios has finally decided that they're going to, like, I guess, get serious about this whole Universal Monsters cinematic universe thing they've been talking about for a couple of years, that they tried to get off with that Dracula the Untold story.
Untold. They've technically tried several times. They also made that Frankenstein movie with Daniel Radcliffe. They've done a lot of these that were intended, like, if this one works, and then none of them do because they're horrible.
Yes, so... But now they have gotten serious. They've said that this Mummy movie that's coming out, I guess this year with Tom Cruise and Russell Crowe, is going to be the first movie in the Dark Universe, which is the very strange sort of obtuse phrase they have decided to use to refer to their Universal Monster movie universe that will include Johnny Depp, you know, assaulter of his wife, playing the Invisible Man, just like somehow that has slowed his fucking career down at all. It's just weird to keep on seeing him popping up with people just assuming that that's like whatever.
Well, I mean, he has not had a success in years.
Yeah.
It takes Hollywood a while to learn the lesson, but if he has enough fucking flops, and I think this next Pirates could be one of them, you know, maybe at some point. Okay, so we got John.
And then Javier Bardem is going to play Frankenstein's monster, which is actually, that sounds kind of cool.
That's good casting.
But it all really depends on how, like, that would be amazing if they made a very, like, novel, accurate depiction of the Frankenstein's monster. I have absolutely no faith that that's what they're going to do. But if they did, like, you know, like, halfway through the movie, he becomes incredibly smart, which is what the Frankenstein story is originally about, that would be really great. But they've had a whole, like, news cycle thing. They took a photo of all these people in a room together wearing suits that are all involved in this.
And let me guess, they don't have writers or directors for any of
these. No. Okay. Like, they've I mean, literally, they've just said Johnny Depp is going to play the Invisible Man, Javier Bardem is going to play Frankenstein's monster in movies that have not been officially announced. Only the actors playing the lead character have been announced. And that's always the best way to get a solid movie off the ground, is to say, this person is going to play this character in a movie that does not have a screenplay, in a movie that does not have a director, in a movie that does not have, like, anything other than, like, a projected release date. I think for, like, the soonest one is going to be, like, 2019. And also, I think the, it's kind of hard to parse a lot of this information, but it seems like the Frankenstein's monster movie is actually going to be a Bride of the Frankenstein movie. I don't know. It's confusing.
That's the best place to start, right, with the sequel? Yes.
Yeah, I don't know what they're doing with that. Also, apparently Russell Crowe's character in this new Mummy movie is Dr. Jekyll, as in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And that's really important, Jonathan, because I'm about to read you a paragraph that they released about how all of these disparate threads are going to be connected. Are you ready for me to read this paragraph, Jonathan?
I have a prediction, and I want to hear if it's right.
At its organizing principle, Dark Universe films are connected by a mysterious multinational organization known as Prodigium, led by the enigmatic and brilliant Dr. Henry Jekyll. Prodigium's mission is to track, study, and, when necessary, destroy evil embodied in the form of monsters in our world. Working outside the aegis of any government and with practices concealed by millennia of secrecy, Prodigium protects the public from knowledge of the evil that exists just beyond the thin membrane of civilized society, and will go to any length to contain it.
I got a great question.
Uh-huh.
First off.
Yeah.
Has Russell Crowe ever done a sequel?
I have no idea.
I don't think so. So good luck having him as your Nick Fury in this.
Exactly. They've decided Russell Crowe is going to be Nick Fury.
Two, that's a description for a bad Universal Studios theme park ride.
Uh-huh.
It's like what you hear a bad actor say in the TV in the line while you're waiting.
Yeah.
That's not your pitch to investors for a movie universe.
Or it's like the thing that Russell Crowe says in a very, or like some other actor says in a very ominous way for like the opening credits sequence for your TV pilot that never got picked up.
Yeah.
For Prodigium, the TV series.
Boy.
Yeah, so apparently,
here's the thing.
Yeah, they've decided fucking Dr. Jekyll, as played by Russell Crowe, from who's being introduced in a Mummy movie that is set like in modern times, starring Tom Cruise, is going to be the Nick Fury of the Universal Monster movie thing. Even though Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde is not a Universal Monster at all, I don't even know how they got wrapped in.
This should have been the easiest slam dunk of this age of interconnected universes for Universal.
Because they already did it once.
Yes. All you have to do, and this shouldn't be as hard as it sounds now, mm-hmm. is find some interesting filmmakers. These don't have to be high-budget movies.
Nope.
These should be little horror movies like they were back in the day, frankly, and say, all right, who would like to do an interesting take on Dracula? Who would like to take an interesting take on Frankenstein? I don't understand how no one has asked Guillermo del Toro to make a Universal Monster movie.
Yeah,
because that just feels like, one, he would do it,
yeah,
and two, he would do it well, mm-hmm. and you would just be able to trust that thing, whatever it was. And so it's like, we don't have any superheroes. We're all right on 8 Fast and Furious movies, and we can't really do an interconnected universe out of that.
But you know what? Our studio is famous for making cinematic adaptations of public domain characters. So
fuck
let's
it.
Just do that.
Let's do that and pretend they're superheroes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a horrible idea. It's going to bomb. It's going to bomb hard. The Mummy is going to bomb when it comes out this summer. I'm just predicting that now because no one wants to see it and it looks bad. I mean,
that gaffe like a year ago or so when the first trailer came out, so that it got released without the proper audio, is like one of the most amazing things
I've ever seen come out of a studio. And it's the only reason anyone knows that movie's coming out.
It's so good.
Tom Cruise movies don't do good unless they're Mission Impossible films. That's just kind of an organizing principle these days, because old school film stars are not what sell films anymore.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't seem to understand that. So, yeah, but it's funny. It's cute for them for trying.
Yeah, and it really says something that, like, you know, for Marvel movies, when the Marvel movie stuff got started, I was super excited about it because I was a huge Marvel Comics fan, and then they're making, like, good movie adaptations of these characters I've loved for years up to that point in the comic books. I am also someone who, like, I love those classic Universal Monster movies. Dracula and Frankenstein are, like, two of my favorite movies I've ever seen. Like, I grew up with those movies. I watch the Universal Horror Monster movies basically on cycle every year in Halloween. I kind of, like, move on to, like, okay, I'm going to do Dracula this year. Next year I do, like, Frankenstein. Then I'll do, like, Wolfman. I love those movies to death. I also love the novels that, like, Frankenstein might be like my favorite novel. Like, it's way up there. Dracula, I think, is an incredible novel. I've read Frankenstein 3 times. I've read Dracula 2 times. Like, I've read Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I fucking love this stuff to death, and I have no interest, literally zero interest, in seeing any of these fucking movies, especially when their connecting thread is Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Dr. Jekyll slash Mr. Hyde is running a secret multinational organization called Prodigium that protects us from the evil of the monsters in the world.
This is stupid.
It's really fucked stupid.
All right, let's talk about one more thing. And this is our last piece of movie news, but it's also kind of a piece of gaming news.
Okay.
And I'm very proud of this transition.
Oh, it's such a good segue. I mean, you spent a whole 30 seconds on it, the pre-production for the podcast.
So you know that Uncharted movie they're trying to make?
Yes, that's really never going to get made, even with this piece of news.
No, it's probably never going to get made. They have had more directors than I can count, more writers than I can count on this
thing. I think Ridley Scott was making it at some point.
Oh, sure. Yeah, everyone was making this at some point. There was a whole period where Nathan Fillion was at a fan campaign to play Nathan Drake. And now he's like 60 or something.
Yeah.
I'm kidding. But, you know, that's not going to happen.
He's got all that Destiny money. He doesn't need this.
They've taken one step further to maybe do something with this, which is that they are now planning on doing a Uncharted movie as like a prequel with a young Nathan Drake, kind of like those scenes in Uncharted 3, which are great scenes.
Or like the beginning of the third Indiana Jones movie.
Sure.
Or the attached young Indiana Jones TV show they made that nobody ever remembers.
With Tom Holland, everyone's favorite Spider-Man.
Yes.
Or current Spider-Man, and just general cool dude and actor, going to play a young Nathan Drake. They had been having a script written by Joe Carnahan, who I like as a director, although he wasn't going to direct it, which was weird. And he apparently is off the project now because they have to completely re-script it because you can't have Tom Holland play like a 30-year-old Nathan Drake.
Although it'd be pretty amazing if they tried to.
That'd be great. Whoever they got as Elena Fraser would just look taller at least. Like, they might not be taller. They would look taller.
I mean, it would make their relationship very creepy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Elena Fraser, that's two different characters. You know what I mean.
Yes, yeah.
So it's being directed by Sean Levy, who has directed some family films, some good, some bad. And yeah, so it might happen, it might not. I will say that's probably the most interesting take for an Uncharted movie I've heard so far.
Yeah, like at least that would like theoretically could coexist with the video games in like stories in a way that could be kind of interesting. In a way that like adapting like the plot of Uncharted 1, the video game, for a movie would be the most boring decision in the world. This is better than that.
Like, if you got... Okay, Tom Holland would do good at this.
Yeah, sure.
If you got a good guy to play Sully.
Sully is, I think, the trickiest bit of casting, honestly.
But if you got a good Sully, you got a good, you know, Nathan there, I think you could do a fun prequel kind of movie with this. I also don't think... Good movies don't come out of 10 years of development hell, generally. No. So...
Also, good movies do not come out of Hollywood trying to make movies about video games.
Yeah, that's true. That still has never been proven wrong.
Yeah, I still have never had the courage to actually go watch that Assassin's Creed movie, even though I am so morbidly curious about it.
If we ever, like, start a Patreon, Sean, that'll have to be, like, our first month bonuses. We'll do an audio commentary or a podcast on Assassin's Creed.
Oh, that would be terrible. Jesus Christ.
Now we can never do that.
Yeah, that's a bad idea.
Anyway,
the only thing worse would be we're going to do another fucking episode of the podcast on fucking Prometheus.
Yeah, well,
Prometheus episode 3.
Yes, I don't know. Anything else to say about this? It's not
going
to happen.
It's never going to happen. It's never going to happen. But if it does, this would be an okay way to do it. I want to hear who they would want to cast as Sully, because legitimately, I think that is actually the harder role to cast.
It
to
is
get to like nail it.
You know, the only person I would want, like I can think of off the top of my head to play it. He's too old, and it's John Goodman.
Mm-hmm.
Would be an amazing Sully. I know he played a character named Sully, but it's also like he just would be that character. He's sadly, I think, too old for that.
I mean, they could just get Tom Hanks, and he could just be playing Sully from Sully, the movie Sully.
That'd be a very different Sully.
Yeah, but I mean, they're making their Sully cinematic universe. Everyone's on it. The Dark Sully.
There was that week Tom Hanks hosted SNL, and they had some good Sully sketches.
Yeah.
So maybe we get some of that. Look, that would be no sillier than their pitch for the Dark Universe.
No, it wouldn't.
It wouldn't. All right. Speaking of video games, Destiny, Destiny 2 got announced.
Yes, it did. Yes.
I don't want to spend too much time on this because we could go in a lot, but I just want to get some takes. I mean, they did. It was already announced, but they did a gameplay reveal. My favorite part of that whole thing was the pre-show where they had a long conversation with Lance Reddick, who plays the Vanguard guy.
Yeah, the Titan guy.
The Titan guy. And he's just such a cool dude. And apparently he actually plays and loves Destiny, and I loved that.
Yeah.
But anyway, Yeah, they showed some gameplay. They showed a new cinematic trailer. They talked about it a little bit. On PC, it'll have like an uncapped frame rate and all this cool stuff.
Yeah.
It's going to run on Battle.net, which is...
Yeah, which is interesting.
Which is cool, I think, but crazy because there's never been a non-Blizzard game. But that seems like a smart use of resources for Activision, which owns all of this.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
The Activision shared cinematic universe now.
That would be a good cinematic universe if they did it.
Yeah.
They have a lot of good stuff.
Oh, man, like Warcraft guy and man from Call of Duty and, like, your Warlock character from Destiny all teaming up to take down the bad guys.
With Ghost, but it's Peter Dinklage Ghost.
Exactly, yes.
No. Yeah, so I don't know. Here's my quick reaction.
Okay,
it looked a lot more like a Destiny expansion pack than I thought it was going to.
Yeah, I have, like, a really weird, like, because I had the same reaction at first that I think, like, they did... have clearly not tried to put on, like, a whole new coat of paint and, like, change up all the reload animations and change every little bit of UI to make it look very distinct from Destiny 1. But, like, the more and more I read about, like, the, like, specific mechanical changes they've made of, like, they've changed up the weapon system significantly so that, like, you now have a, like, your primary weapon and your secondary weapon are both the sort of, like, the same kinds of weapons. So, like, you could have, like... an auto rifle as your primary weapon and another auto rifle as your secondary weapon, but the secondary slot is now used up by a weapon that does elemental damage, and your primary slot is one that does kinetic damage.
I think that's a brilliant change. Yeah. I do, yeah.
And then, like, because that also just opens up, hopefully, for, like, a lot a more expanded sort of list of types of weapons you could have in those slots, and then, like, your, like, power weapons, like your big sniper rifles, your rocket launches, your shotguns, those are getting, like, combined. So, like, the heavy weapon and special weapon categories are kind of getting combined, and it seems like some of the special weapon stuff is getting turned into normal weapons, and some of it is getting turned into power weapons. That's cool. They're getting rid of a lot of, like, they're getting rid of the specific stat thing they had of, like, strength, discipline, and intellect, and turning that into, like, more explicit effects that gear have. Like, every single subclass is going to be... they're going to add a bunch of new... they're like, one new subclass at least for each, like, overall class, and then completely retool all the ones that are coming over. So it's like, they're really changing up a lot of stuff about the gameplay under the hood, but they've just sort of kept the, like, surface level, like, the makeup of the game is very identifiably Destiny, which is an interesting approach.
It is, and I should say, that's not a negative for me.
Yeah.
That it looks like an expansion pack. My reaction was, oh, okay, I don't actually really need to look at any more of this until it comes out, because this is not a new thing necessarily. And it's like, okay, I'll play it like I play other Destiny things when it comes out. I'll play it and I'll enjoy it. But I'm not necessarily... It's kind of like a put your expectations in check. Like, okay, this is not a completely different game.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. Some of those mechanical changes sound smart. They get, you know, a fresh start with a lot of this stuff. It sounds like some of the new areas are really cool.
Yeah.
One of those, the European Dead Zone, I mean, that was going to be in, like, Destiny 1. They've been working on that for years.
Yeah, it got cut out relatively early, one of the production of Destiny 1.
So, you know, it seems like it could be neat. You know, it's like, I watched, like, half of that live stream, and I just was like, this is Destiny, and that's great, and that's cool, and I will be happy to play it, but I just hit this point where I was like, okay, I don't need to see any more of it until September, and I will happily give them my $60 to play it.
Yeah, but I have had a lot of fun, like, going in and just reading, like, the nuts and bolts changes they have made are really fascinating and sound like is going to lead to a much better game.
Yeah. You know, Taken King did so much within the framework of Destiny 1 that breaking out of that framework, at least in some ways... you know, it could be a really big boon, even if it's not the whole scale overhaul we thought we might get.
Yeah. Although, like, I think we might actually be surprised about how much is, like, changed about the specifics of the experience when the game actually comes out.
Oh, absolutely. Because you're mentioning some, you know, big things. Like, just if across the board they get rid of some of the useless stuff, like the strength and intellect and discipline, never figured out what any of those did. And I've played hundreds of hours of Destiny.
It was like grenade cooldowns. Melee cooldown and, like, your super cooldown.
Never figured that out.
Yeah,
if they can streamline a lot of that stuff, that alone honestly makes more of a difference than it might sound like.
Yeah, and it looks like also they've stripped out the normal, like, the stat thing they had in your, like, class screen of, like, your agility and recovery and whatever the third one is that, like, different abilities you selected changed how much those stats were. It seems like they're getting rid of that, and it looks like the skill trees I've seen that they've, like, shown little images of, like, seem a, like, much more interesting skill trees that are getting rid of, like, kind of, like, the weird fat skills of, like, oh, this, like, decreases some of your, like, agility but increases your, like, recovery. It's like, who gives a shit? I can barely even tell the difference.
Yeah. All right. Any other stuff to say about Destiny 2?
I'm very excited for that game. I want to play that beta.
I also, the cinematics are good for that game.
Yes.
They look like a lot of fun. Like they look like they maybe took a walk across the campus to Blizzard.
Sure.
I just imagine all the Activision people in a big room or something. And we're like, how do you guys make your cinematics? We want some tips on that because you guys do it really well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, looks fun. Far Cry 5 is apparently going to be set in Montana.
Yeah, this was something that has been sort of rumored for a while. That at first a lot of people were like, oh, it's going to be a Wild West game based on no information at all. And then a lot of people were like, Game Press were like, no, all the, like, everything we've kind of heard is probably going to be set in modern-day Montana. And everyone's like, no, it's going to be set in the Wild West. And it's like, lo and behold, today there was a teaser that showed it's going to be set in modern-day Montana. And some people are getting weirdly mad that it's not set in the Wild West. It's like, you just fucking completely made something up and got yourself worked into tizzy about it. It doesn't even make any sense, but...
The internet, a 1X play.
Yeah, it was really fun to, like, follow these rumors for the past week or two, because I really like Far Cry 3 and Far Cry 4 especially, and so I'm excited to see where they go. I think Montana's an interesting setting to get away from them trying to do this, like...
Exotic
thing, and, like, say, like... Because especially Far Cry 3, like, got stepped into weird, like, very, like, colonialist, imperialist kind of territory with the storytelling of, like, it being, like, very much, like, exotic in a way that's kind of gross in how they're portraying like other cultures, and it's interesting, and it's an interesting idea to sort of like take that lens and turn it back on America, which is I hope they're doing, because like I think the storytelling in Far Cry 4, while not like the most amazing story in the game ever, was really well accomplished for what it was, and I think if you know that team is making a game set in Montana, I have a lot of faith that it's going to be pretty cool.
Yeah, I don't know if I could point out Montana on a map because it's kind of a nondescript state, but, and no offense to any listeners in Montana, you just live in a boring state. I'm kidding.
It's fine. They know it.
Yeah. Colorado is like, it looks beautiful in the places you've seen. It's mostly like bad farmland.
Hey,
it's
okay. Colorado's fucking awesome.
I know.
It's no Montana. Let's not get
too
dismissive of our own state.
I don't know what joke I was making, but it sounds like, honestly, I have not heard of a game set in Montana before. That sounds interesting to me.
Yes, it's going like the other direction of like instead of it being like this like very different setting of like oh it's set in like the mountains of the Himalayas or something. It's like that's cool. There aren't a lot of video games set there. It's like it's set in Montana. It's like oh
yeah.
I guess I have never played a video game set in Montana. You're right, Far Cry 5.
Ubisoft also announced the next Assassin's Creed will be set in Montana, thus setting up their Montana shared gaming universe.
And thus that joke on the podcast is now dead for today. That's the last one we can make. I'm very excited to visit this Montana cinematic universe in the future. I wish I knew literally any other piece of media about Montana so we could keep that joke going.
I know.
But I just don't know anything.
Yeah. It's a very nondescript cinematic universe.
Yeah.
All right.
It's very subtle.
Speaking of the Wild West, Red Dead Redemption 2 was delayed to 2018 because, of course, it was. Why did they ever announce this game was coming out this year?
I don't know.
That's the question.
That is the question. It's like a long list of... Just wait until you're way closer to your release date to fucking announce your video game. Because it's not even like they've used that time for marketing or anything. They released that teaser like half a year ago, and then they haven't said a fucking thing about the video game since. And then the next thing they say is it's getting delayed. Just wait until now and announce your game now instead of announcing it fucking 6 months ago.
It's so weird. You know, it's like one of the things I liked when they announced The Last of Us 2 is that they didn't try to put a date on it or anything. It's just like, we wanted to tell you guys we're making this, but by not putting a date at the end, it's like, all right, we're not expecting this anytime soon.
Yeah.
Red Dead should have just done the same thing if they had to get it. Maybe they had to get an ad out for shareholders or something. Who knows? But it's like, yeah, that was stupid. We all knew it was stupid. It wasn't coming out this year. Now it's coming out next year. Maybe it'll be better than Grand Theft Auto 5. I don't know.
But at least, like, you know, in this, like, crazy tipsy-topsy world we live in now, it's nice to know that video games still will never hit their release date. It's, like, the one thing you can still rely on.
Yes.
That, like, keeps the world trucking. It's this familiar thing I can hold on to at night and just cling to it and be like, at least I know, at least I'm right about something. I knew Red Dead Redemption 2 wasn't going to come out this year, and I was right, and I feel very comfortable in that.
It definitely makes me feel better after we were so wrong about Mass Effect Andromeda.
Yeah. Well, were we?
It shouldn't have come out when it did, but it did, and that was surprising.
Yeah.
For a number of reasons, including...
I don't think we were wrong. I don't count that as being wrong. I think everyone knows that, including the people making it, that game should have been delayed.
Well, I want to talk about a game that was announced like 3 months ago and just got released, and I'm loving. So, quick review of the first like 10 hours of Fire Emblem Echoes, Shadows of Valentia.
Yeah.
This is the new Fire Emblem game for 3DS. This is a remake, sort of, asterisk, of the Famicom game Fire Emblem Gaiden, which was the second ever Fire Emblem game, had never been released outside of Japan, maybe some other countries, but like not definitely not to North America or English-speaking countries, never localized. And so it's just been one of these kind of, one of many pieces of missing Fire Emblem history for us Western fans who only got to start enjoying the series after Smash Bros. Melee and all that.
Yeah.
So, coming out to 3DS, it uses like a lot of the, you know, engine stuff from Awakening and Fates, the other 3DS games. But there's more to it than it just being like a remake of the Famicom game. And that's one of the most fascinating things about it so far. First off, this game is just fucking fantastic.
Okay.
I want to say that. It's so great, so I won't bury the lead on that. But I am constantly playing this and being like, what if this was in the Famicom game and what wasn't? And it's kind of surprising from what I've been able to gather what was and wasn't. Because first off, presentation-wise, this is by far the best Fire Emblem game.
No.
It is fully voice acted. And not just like almost every line. It's not even like Persona, where Persona is, you know, voice acted, but you get a lot of stuff that's just like the text and whatnot.
Huh.
Right.
And then you read some text.
Yeah. There's almost none of even that. Like, they really went to town on it, and the dub and the localization is phenomenal. Like, it is a Persona-caliber dub in a Fire Emblem game. Obviously, on 3DS, you can't have the kind of bells and whistles you would have in, like, a bigger RPG.
Right.
It is more visual novel-esque when you go through that. But it is still, like, just playing a Fire Emblem game with this rich a story, with, you know, this rich of voice acting. And I should also say, so many of the actors are Persona actors in this. It's kind of amazing. Because I went from Persona 5 to Puyo Puyo Tetris, which is like all Persona actors, to this, which is like all Persona actors. This has old Igor in it.
Oh.
Playing multiple roles. And it also led me to realize old Igor also voiced Ikutsuki. Never figured that out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I was able to hear it. Because one character he voiced sounded like Igor, and one sounded like Ikutsuki, and then all came together for me. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so you get a lot of Persona actors in this, and that's fun. But it's a great dub. The overall just sense of style to the game, like, it does for Fire Emblem what Persona 5 did for Persona, and that it feels like kind of the most stylish, just cool-looking, polished version of itself it could be. Like, when you're on the battlefield and, you know, on the top screen you're looking at your units and stuff, on the bottom it always shows your unit information. Well, in this game they've added to that there's a big portrait of your character that is this just beautiful drawing on the bottom screen, and then all the other elements just look so cool and stylish, where it's just fun to, like, go around the menus of this game. So with that, and with the very, you know, wonderful storytelling they have, there's more cutscenes than ever before. They have more, like, in-engine 3D cutscenes. And then, of course, just the normal where people are talking and you actually have voice acting here. That's all kind of amazing, but it leads me to my first thought about, like, how was this a Famicom game?
Right.
This might have the most in-depth story I've played in a Fire Emblem game. Mm. And that's crazy to me. I assume a lot of this writing was not in the Famicom game because, you know, NES games didn't have a lot of writing.
Yeah.
Even like a Final Fantasy III or something, which is much more text-heavy than games of its time, isn't that text-heavy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So
because I'm still playing the Famicom era Dragon Quest, and like they are, you can definitely tell the difference.
Yeah, so I don't know what was added and what was not, but it all feels very modern, very of a piece with modern Fire Emblem, but with a level of polish that I don't think I've seen in this series before, maybe, where it's just like the writing and the characterization is so good and so on point, and the story moves in such interesting directions, and there's kind of enough nuance to all the storytelling where, if you know, and it probably feels like there's more cutscenes and dialogue and stuff because it's all voice acted, so it just takes longer to get through, but it really does feel like you spend more time in the story, and I don't regret that at all. Like, I really find the story engaging. It's like reading a good book and then putting down the book every once in a while to play like a super challenging game of chess or something, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's a fun part of it. So the presentation is great. I don't know where that stuff came in terms of what was in the Famicom game, what wasn't, but then also, this feels like by far the most different Fire Emblem game of everything that's come out in the US, and almost like, oh, these are interesting innovations, and then you have to remember, no, this was the second game ever in the series, and there were no conventions yet.
Yeah.
So apparently in Japan, Fire Emblem Gaiden is kind of considered in the same light as like Zelda 2, where people don't dislike the game. In fact, it's a classic in some circles, but it's just very, very different.
Right.
And so, like, you know how every Fire Emblem game like you and I have played has this chapter structure,
mm-hmm.
where every chapter has some story and then a big battle, and then the story continues, and then you go to the next chapter.
Yeah.
Right? And in some Fire Emblem games, you also have to go on the world map with that, but that is the general structure of them. Fire Emblem Gaiden / Echoes is not like that at all. It's you basically, everything is split into acts. I'm in Act 3 right now, and every act has a lot of story, a lot of battles, some small, some big. You basically are moving on this big world map, and like the enemy units, like there'll be an army over there, and you can move to attack it, or you can wait, and it'll come to attack you. There's also places to go in, so like if you visit a town, it'll almost be like, it reminds me of like a 90s PC point-and-click game, where there will be a backdrop of the town, and maybe some people standing around there, also very visual novel-esque, and like you'll click on them to talk to them and get information, or you can kind of do this first person look around the area and see if you can find like, oh, there's a carrot over there, I can use that for food later, grab that.
Just go to this town and pick a random carrot off the ground and like, I'm gonna use this for food later.
You do this a lot in this game.
Your army seems like it's in some pretty dire straits that you're that excited about one carrot.
Exactly. And so you move around the towns, you do that kind of stuff, and there are full-fledged 3D dungeons to explore.
Oh, jeez.
It's insane. And I think at the Famicom version, obviously they weren't 3D, but it was still the same idea of you go into a dungeon and you control your character, and when you find an, I don't know how, it was probably random encounters on the Famicom, I have no idea, but in this there will be like an enemy on screen, you attack it, very much like in Persona 3 and 4, where like you have to like use your weapon and hit it, and then it starts a Fire Emblem battle with the person that you did that, and so those dungeons can actually be pretty challenging, because you might have to do 4 or 5 Fire Emblem battles between saves.
Jesus.
And they're shorter ones, they're often pretty easy, but it's still a lot. Like, I did wipe once and lost like 40 minutes of progress.
Yeah.
Or I didn't wipe, but I lost like my only archer, and it's like, this is Fire Emblem, he's not coming back.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, but it's crazy. Like, you go into these dungeons, and you are controlling your character, and on the 3DS, it's in 3D, it uses the C-stick on the new 3DS, so you're moving the camera and everything, and you're walking around a dungeon, you explore, you can, like, break barrels and find shit, and fight people, and then there's this whole system with, like, these goddess statues you have to find. Almost reminds me of, like, Breath of the Wild, because that's where you go to, like, trade in your shit and upgrade your characters and heal and stuff like that. And, yeah, the dungeons are not, like, the main part, but they're, like, in towns and places, and you go there, and you have to, like, do things in the dungeons, and then you go back to the main screen. So there's actually a lot of variety to the gameplay in this, even though it all ultimately kind of boils down to Fire Emblem tactical battles. It feels like you're doing a lot of different kinds of things as you play, and it also gives them a lot of different vectors to kind of tell the story. It's not just, you know, cutscene battle, cutscene battle.
Right.
It's a really interesting game, and those changes, like, if you hadn't told me that this was a remake of a Famicom game, I might just assume, oh, this team, you know, they did what they did with Awakening and Fates, and now they wanted to do something else, and this is really different, and it's fun, and it's interesting. You know, there's lots of other things that are different because it's older, like there's no weapon triangle in this one.
Oh, geez.
They did not try to, like, it was not in the NES game, and they didn't try to, like, kind of graft it on here, so it's much more like when you hit other units, it's almost like a more traditional RPG battle where it might take... It definitely takes more skirmishes between your units. Like in a lot of Fire Emblem games, with the right people, you go up, you kill them in one hit.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot less of that in this one. And so it, like the whole tactical side of it just automatically changes because of that. You don't have to give your characters weapons. They kind of already have them, although you can give them like upgraded weapons. But for like the magic users, and this is a change I would keep for modern games, you don't have to buy them tomes and all that shit.
Okay,
they just learn spells like in Final Fantasy or something. And so that's kind of interesting. But, like, it drains their health when they use them.
Oh.
So it adds this whole other kind of... Usually it's just, like, one hit point. But it does add other things to think about. Healers are more useful as, like, you know, battlers as well, too. Because they have some magic, some dark magic that's interesting. So it's a really, really different Fire Emblem game. But it's also really good. Like, I have been enjoying it so fucking much. It really does feel like, because they're building this at least off the bones of the Famicom game, even though they've clearly added a lot, I think just calling this a remake is doing it a disservice. It's obviously a lot more than that.
Right.
Or a remaster, as I've heard some people say. It's not a remaster. It's a full-fledged remake. It feels like because they were building off the bones of a Famicom game, they were able to take all that time that they would put into like designing systems and writing and just polish the shit out of everything. And so it just feels like moment to moment... Absolutely one of the best Fire Emblem games I've played. One of the best games on the 3DS. It's absolutely beautiful. I still am in awe of what developers are able to do on the 3DS in its, you know, latter day at this point. In that the 3DS is not a powerful system, but
right.
There are some beautiful images and stuff on it. The 3D actually works really interestingly in this game. Some of those cutscenes are gorgeous. The writing, as I said, is just so good moment to moment. And the dub is, and the, just the voice acting is so good moment to moment. It's really great. And the story's an interesting one. In some ways, it's a traditional Fire Emblem thing because it's about two kingdoms at war. But like the vantage point of it is very different. It's about these two characters, Alm and Celica, and they grew up together in this small little town. But and they were told like they were cousins or something, but they're not actually. Celica, like Alm's supposed grandfather, like adopted her because she was in danger from something, and you know she's a hidden princess and stuff like that.
Sure, yeah.
But like Alm and Celica are really great friends. Eventually, like when they're kids, when they're like seven, she has to go away to live on an island and be a priestess or something. So they've always wanted to see each other again. One day, the evil kingdom invades the nice kingdom, and Alm joins the Deliverance, which is a fantastic name for a rebel group.
Okay, yeah.
And he becomes the leader of the Deliverance, kind of like a Luke Skywalker kind of thing, to go like fight the evil empire. And meanwhile, Celica sets out on this journey to try to reawaken this slumbering goddess. And they kind of meet, and the way their paths converge, and the way they both have their own armies and separate, you know, command structures. But unlike in, say, Fire Emblem Fates, which is like has like its two paths, or even like the Sacred Stones or something like that, you go back and forth constantly. And you can even choose it in the act I'm in. Like, I could move Celica and go on with her story, or I could move Alm and move on with his story. And it doesn't pressure you one way or another, and that's kind of interesting. So there's just, like, there's always stuff happening. You never really get bored, because even if, like, it's like, oh, I fought with this character for, like, five battles. Oh, I could go hang out with Celica and do that battle. And her, like, right-hand woman is voiced by Makoto from Persona 5, and that's just fucking cool. So, you know.
Does she ride a motorcycle?
No. This is, like, it is medieval.
I mean, you said you were going to awaken a slumbering goddess. You can go find a motorcycle in that premise somewhere.
Yeah, no, but it's really cool. The music, I should say, is fantastic. It's based on the Famicom music, and if you get this, got the special edition, which is a really cool special edition, it comes with the soundtrack, and they did a fun thing for the soundtrack where it's a set of, it'll have the Famicom track and then the new track, and you can compare them. And it's just fun to hear, like, how do musicians take, like, you know, basically a two-line Famicom melody and turn that into a modern orchestral kind of thing, and they do a really good job at it. The only thing I feel missing from, like, Awakening and Fates is that those games did this really cool thing where on the battle screen there would be a piece of music playing, and when you zoomed in and did a battle, there would be a battle version of that music playing, but it would come in at the same spot, so it sounded seamless, but the music would change. Here, there's a separate, like, battle screen and, like, field screen music, which you would expect from a game of its era, obviously. Yeah. And so you just, like, the transition orally is a little rougher, even though it's smoother than it's ever been visually. But, you know, that's just what it is. Right. It's cool. The music is still very good. I love the hell out of this game. You know, I thought Fire Emblem Fates was ambitious and really interesting, but ultimately didn't come together for me. This is outstanding and is, you know, stands on par with Awakening as just two phenomenal 3DS titles, and I cannot wait to go back and keep playing it. And I should also say, you're probably okay playing it on normal difficulty. There's a normal and a hard.
Right.
And you might think, I played a lot of Fire Emblem, maybe I should do this one on hard, and you might totally have fun with that. I started on normal, and for a while I thought, I should have picked hard. This is too easy. This is like, it's fun, but it's like a little too grindy for me in that I'm just kind of tearing through things. It gets hard. I spent like 2.5 hours on a battle earlier today that I tried like 30 times, and it was just so many trial and errors, but I love it. Those are the moments in Fire Emblem that like make that game for me.
Yeah.
Especially when you're like 20 minutes into a battle and you're like, God, I lost my archer, but can I do this again?
It's like, I lost my archer. If I'm being totally honest, Will the Archer was kind of a prick.
Yeah.
It's like, I think I can accept that Will the Archer's dead. Like, I mean, I liked him a lot when he was here, but now that he's not here and I'm reflecting on my experiences with Will the Archer, I really don't think I appreciated him that much. It's not that I don't want to replay this 2-hour-long battle. It's just that he was a dick.
Yeah, I mean, but I wound up finally getting through this battle with no deaths, and it was the greatest feeling in the world. Like, this one battle will... There are some Fire Emblem matches that, like, stick in my mind. They are scarred into me. There's one in the Sacred Stones on a ship, where you're in the middle, and there's ships on either side.
Mm-hmm.
One of the hardest things I've ever done.
Yeah, I haven't played that game in, like, over 10 years, and you said, on a ship, and I immediately saw that screen in my head.
It's so difficult. This one that I played this afternoon, and again, I'm pretty early in the game, probably, but, like... So there's this giant army of cavalier, like, mounted horse knights in the middle, like, 10 of them. And then you only get, like, 8 or 9 units. Mm. And they're split into a unit of, like, 5 at the bottom, 2 on the side, and 3 at the very top. There's a team of archers in the top left. There's another team of archers and horse riders in the top right. And your team is completely split. It's one of the hardest things I've ever done in a video game. But it felt so great when my plan kind of came together in the end. And no one had to die, even though one of my archers came very close. It's always the archers.
They're just very weak, yeah. You know? It's like, just because you're an archer doesn't mean you can't put some fucking armor on, dude. Like, yeah. You stand really far away and shoot arrows at people. Like, fucking put on some plate armor, asshole.
Yeah. But no, I mean, you know, Fire Emblem, I think, is one of the most significant stories to come out of the 3DS era, because the 3DS basically revitalized Fire Emblem, and Fire Emblem, in turn, I think, gave the 3DS a different audience, too. And so it feels right that we get at least one more of these on the 3DS. This is, in some ways, better than any of them, and it's just it's a good swan song for that series on this console, and I look forward to playing more of it and just having some more tough battles.
Cool.
Yeah. So just yet another kind of notch in the 3DS is, you know,
yeah.
It's just got so many good games at this point.
Yeah, I was, a couple of days ago, I was looking at thinking about, I should get a 3DS, because I was thinking about, there's a lot of, like, because I'm playing through Dragon Quest III, and I'm getting kind of, I think, close to the end, and it's like, well, there are, like, all these, like, DS remakes of 4, 5, and 6, and there's, like, 3DS remakes of 7 and 8. It's like, well, I can play the DS versions on the 3DS, and I was looking at it, and I realized the 3DS is not, is region locked. So I can't play Japanese carts.
Oh, because you would want to keep playing them on the...
Yes, because, yeah. Like, I've played the fucking first three ones in Japanese. It'd feel weird to switch over now because all the spell names and everything are different. I was like, nope, I was this close, then stymied by something small and mostly meaningless, but I just can't take that last step.
I almost bought you a 2DS the other day because I saw one online for $50 and I thought it would be hilarious.
You should have just done it.
It would have been funny. Maybe next time.
Yeah, if you want to, I am not going to say no. If you want to buy me a 2DS, I will accept that gladly.
I just want to watch you play it for like 5 minutes because I think it would be funny.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, let's go ahead and move on. You want to talk some Doctor Who?
Talk about some Doctor Who?
I don't even know what you say about this episode.
I mean, I don't even know, like, are we even here talking about that episode? Like, I'm not even sure. This podcast happening?
Like the episode itself, let's rewind a bit.
Okay, yeah.
Extremis by Stephen Moffat.
Yeah.
Spoilers from here on out for the 6th episode of Series 10, and you do not want this one spoiled.
No,
because
yeah.
It's a fucking thing. All right, so going into this, last week, Sean, we talked about the excellent episode Oxygen by
yes.
Jenny Matheson.
Yeah.
Where the Doctor was blinded.
Yes, he's still blind.
He's still blind. Of all the surprises in Extremis, one of the greatest, I think, is he's still fucking blind at the end of this episode.
Yeah.
And there is no end to that in sight.
Uh-huh.
That might just be the rest of Capaldi's run.
Yeah, I really have no idea. Because it is, like, there's no indication that that is getting fixed anytime soon. And holy shit, they're just going with that.
They are going with it. They are going for it. So Extremis is Moffat's first episode of the season since the premiere.
Yeah.
It's kind of his, you know, mid-season episode he does. But not at all, I think, what we expected. Because
no.
This has some story arc things in it, and it's setting up a larger 2-3, who knows how many parter they're going to be doing with this. But it's also, it's a standalone, like, Doctor Who story in a lot of ways. And a fascinating one.
Yeah.
It's got a flashback structure. It's got a false ending. It's got a hell of a cliffhanger.
Yeah.
It's got a Super Mario joke that is amazing. It's scary.
So
this is a fucking episode of Doctor Who, Sean.
Yeah, this is one of those where it just feels like, something that I feel like Stephen Moffat has done very good in the Peter Capaldi years is kind of reviving a little bit of the edge he had as a writer on Doctor Who in the RTD years, that it felt like the Matt Smith era, and I think this was partially informed by Matt Smith's sort of performance as a Doctor, it got like very bombastic, very big, it became like almost like action-y in some ways. Like, it's obviously, like, Doctor Who has never been an action show, but it had a more sort of like action adventure kind of bent to the feel of the show, and sometimes that was amazing and sometimes it didn't work as well. But here, with I think a lot of inspired by Peter Capaldi's more restrained performance of the Doctor, it feels like Stephen Moffat has gone back to this like weird, edgy fucking thing, but like gone, they've taken that and like fucking turned the dial way up. And the first indication of that was his episode Listen from season 8, which is phenomenal. And obviously, like Last Christmas is a really weird, dark, quirky, strange Christmas special. Like Heaven Sent is
the weirdest, darkest, quirkiest.
Yeah, like one of the most insane episodes of Doctor Who before this one.
Of
and,
TV.
Yeah, and so like you had that with Heaven Sent. And then now this is like, then it felt like we had a more like heartwarming kind of Stephen Moffat with the Christmas specials. And then obviously like setting up the season had like, that's just like a very sort of like functional episode because it has a very important function it needs to fulfill and it fulfills that function. And then now we come to fucking Extremis and Stephen Moffat's like, He's rolling up the sleeves. He's cracking his knuckles. He's going, okay, this is my last season of Doctor Who. I'm going to fucking work out a cranker with this one. Like, this one's going out of the park. This one's going out of the park and, like, going through the hologram that is the moon that we thought was a moon and is not actually the moon, because that's how fucking... I'm pulling the plug on reality. I'm fucking going for it. And he goes for it in this episode.
It's amazing that this episode exists.
Yeah.
The episode ended and I felt more unsettled than maybe I ever have watching a Doctor Who episode.
Uh-huh.
Because it, like, it's not just the questioning of reality, it's that this episode keeps you on your toes. Like, honestly, we're going to talk about Twin Peaks soon. It is not a dissimilar feeling of, like, a weird Lynch movie of, like, at a certain point, I don't know why things are happening, I don't know how this adds up, and the scariest thing is, I don't know if or how it can.
Uh-huh.
And that's the big... And Moffat has no interest in giving you all that by the end of this. I think there's indications we will get more of this in weeks to come. But, like, and I do think this episode works completely on its own.
Oh, absolutely.
It's not just part one of something.
I mean, honestly, like, I'm curious to see what the next episode is like, but there's a part of me that almost feels like it should, like this episode should have had the exact same ending, and then the next episode not followed up on it at all. Like, maybe there's one line of dialogue kind of referencing that the Doctor defeated the enemies from this episode or something, but not show you the actual adventure and just be like, this is it. And the Doctor, you just have to assume and have faith that the Doctor uses the information he gains from the, like, course of events in this episode and uses that to defeat them, but we're not even going to show you. I kind of almost went with that. And I think it would have been maybe a step too far for, you know, like a television show airing on BBC, but
yeah,
it would have been pretty fucking amazing.
Yeah, because this is like a 45-minute episode, normal length, and by the end of it, so much ground has been covered. And so many scares and laughs have been had. Like, I mean, you almost forget that half of this episode is all the stuff with the papacy.
Yeah.
And you go to the Vatican fucking library and go behind a portrait of a Pope Benedict, one of the many Benedicts. Yeah,
but this one was a lady.
This one was a lady.
Which she wasn't. He wasn't.
No.
But in Doctor Who, she was.
Which is fun.
Yeah.
And there's just all this scary stuff in the library. Peter Capaldi is playing the blind very interestingly.
Yeah.
And you get these new enemies that are just pure nightmare fuel and all this stuff. I love the whole setup. Like, it is established so economically of the Pope comes to the Doctor. Like, why would the Pope come to the Doctor? And it's, okay, we have this book. It's called The Veritas.
Yeah.
We finally translated it. Everyone who's read it is dead, and they committed suicide.
Yeah, and the last time people translated this book, like 500 years ago, they all died then, too.
It is such a beautiful, wonderful, Moffat-esque setup. Like, that's Blink. That is, Blink Moffat 101 done well.
Like, it almost, like, that scene kind of reminded me of, like, good Sherlock Stephen Moffat in some ways.
Yeah.
Of, like, having this character come in, sort of, like, set the stakes and, like, explain the setup for this, like, mystery. And the Doctor being like, oh, I guess we need to figure this one out. It's, like, had that, like you said, very economic quality to the setup of the story.
And if just, again, kind of tying the character stuff into it, the Doctor being blind is such an integral part of this episode because, you know, if the Doctor were in totally good health, I don't think this would be nearly as interesting because him choosing to take this on would be like, yeah, the Doctor does that. Here it's, yeah, the Doctor does that, but you can't read right now, Doctor.
Yeah.
You're not in any condition to take on this fucking mystery, but he's going to do it.
Yeah.
And he's going to get really in over his head for the second week in a row.
Yes.
And it's going to be unsettling.
It's going to be more than just unsettling. Yeah, because it is something where the episode covers so much ground. I love the way that, like, the Next Time trailer stuff had, like, from that they have been doing for Doctor Who forever with New Doctor Who. At the end of each episode, they show, like, a little tiny teaser for the next episode. This episode uses that to such great effect because I think everyone just went into this expecting, like, there's going to be, like, more stuff shown about the vault than they were, like, hinting at in that Next Time trailer. But we were just like, it's going to be a cool adventure in, like, the Vatican, which is something that Doctor Who's never gone there. It's just like, okay, this is going to be cool, like, zombie monks, like, okay. And you think you kind of understand more or less the kind of episode it's going to be going into it. And then it's like, you have no idea what this episode is doing until, like, the last 10 minutes. Not really.
Yeah, I don't even know really how to talk about this. But my mind keeps going to, one, Nardole is such a key figure here.
Yes.
I don't think you can overstate how good Matt Lucas is.
No.
He's such a great addition to this cast. and him kind of having to be the doctor in a sense here, especially in his relations with Bill, because he's the one kind of leading her around. And you get some funny interactions. But throughout the episode, you keep getting these... And this is one of those like off-kilter things I love. They'll keep being these portals, like from the game Portal, show up in the wall. And characters don't really react to them. The doctor, because he can't see them. And the other characters, because there's this kind of dreamlike atmosphere to everything. So that's unsettling enough. But then finally, Dol and Bill start going through the portals.
Yeah.
And they're in the Pentagon, and they're in... Where else do they go?
They go to the Pentagon, and then I think they go to CERN next. Yeah. And then Bill
then they realize, the White House. Yeah. They're the White House, all this stuff. But like they're going through these portals, and it's really weird. But it's like at this point, it's like normal Doctor Who weird, more or less. It's just you can feel something more is coming. And then they get back in, and Nardole gives basically what is a Doctor Who kind of moment where he explains things. And he's like, these are projections. And it's like, what the fuck are you talking about, Nardole? Yeah. And this is coming on the heels of one of the most aggressively weird sequences in Doctor Who history, which is they're in the CERN building. All the CERN scientists have strapped dynamite to the tables and are drinking till it's like a cult end of the world thing. And the CERN guy just starts saying, all right, say some numbers. And they start saying the same numbers and saying the same numbers. And they're doing this whole like party with it.
Yeah.
And then Nardole and Nardole and Bill just run away. And it's all a projection. And Nardole goes up in digital flames.
Yeah, because basically, like, it's such a brilliant scene where Nardole's like, that's all a projection. But wait, if the projectors are here and projecting over here, then what happens if you go behind? And he like sticks his hand behind the projector and his hand just like... you know, reverse digitizes from like Tron or whatever, and then he's like, I'm not real! I'm not real! And then he fucking just explodes. And that's the moment where you're like, oh fuck.
This is a mind fuck.
Yeah, oh fuck. Because that's where the moment where like the whole rest of the episode you've already seen is playing through your head again. You're like, was there a point where this switched? Is like, was Nardole specifically not real? Are all the characters fake? I mean, Bill was saying all the numbers, so is Bill fake? Is the Doctor fake? Did this happen last episode? This happened at the beginning of this episode? Like, where? What the fuck is going on?
And you know, when we get on with it, where the whole thing is a simulation, there's a lot to break down in that scene in the White House, which is amazing that they broke out a fucking Oval Office set to film this one.
Like, part of me is just hoping that they had that stuff in some corner from like season 6 where they had like Richard Dixon and all that crap and just like kept that set.
I'm guessing the BBC has at least one White House set on standby.
It seems like the economic thing to do at some point.
Yeah. Doctor Who can't be the only show using it. But no, even before that, like, there is such kind of a weird off-kilter atmosphere to everything that in lesser hands, this should be the kind of revelation that just pisses you off in some ways because it's the, oh, none of this was real.
Yeah.
But it's not that at all. It's so beyond and such a mindfuck version of that where, like, literally you're seeing all these places, they're going through these portals, and you get into this stark white room which looks like something out of a Kubrick sci-fi movie, the weird parts of a Kubrick sci-fi movie or something. And then it's like, yeah, these are just projections and you're not real. And then Bill goes in and finds a very depressed doctor sitting in the Oval Office with a dead president on the ground, having apparently taken a bunch of pain pills or something.
Yeah, unfortunately, it doesn't look like Donald Trump, so we didn't get to play out that fantasy yet.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Yeah, but yeah, that scene in the White House, like, that was a scene that after I finished watching the episode, I just went back and watched it again immediately because that was something that, you know, Bill did not have as much to do in this episode as she has had in most of the episodes this season. Like, they have generally focused on her because, she's a new companion and you need to develop her. But for most of the episode, she wasn't kind of front and center. It was more about the doctor and his blindness and honestly, his relationship with Nardole and Nardole having to cover for that. But then this, I think, is one of the most key scenes for Bill so far, which is kind of, like, crazy when you think about that. It's not, quote-unquote, actual Bill. But the scene where she comes in and you know that she knows that she's not real. Like, she must know. Like she said all the numbers. She saw Nardole explode. Like, she fucking knows. And the doctor knows she knows. But she just can't accept it. And having to sit down and the doctor having to very slowly explain this. All while you're also on pins and needles because you're not 100% sure if the doctor's fake or not. Because that's... Even though in... Because for me, like, I knew logically it would make way more sense for him to be fake. Like, it would be, you'd have to come up with a big, weird explanation for why the doctor would be the only one who is not created by this digital simulation. But he's also, like, the main character of the show. like, the show is called Doctor Who. I know that's not his name, but it's definitely talking about him. And so you just don't think about a show doing an episode of the show where the main character is a, like artificial simulacrum of the main character. And, I mean, he doesn't die on screen, but he dies. Like, that version of the Doctor you follow for the entire episode is killed at the end of this episode. It's like, it feels like maybe Stephen Moffat has some sort of weird sort of, like, issues with Doctor Who, that he's been on it for so long. He has maybe some, like, love-hate issues going on, because, man, has he killed the Doctor a lot in the past couple of years. If you tally up everything that happened in Heaven's Sit, like, he's really sort of, like, putting the Doctor through the grinder. But even knowing, like, even having seen Heaven's Sit, I found it really unsettling to have that, like, revelation. And, again, it's something that, like, I love the way Peter Capaldi plays it. It's so quiet. It's such a quiet, nothing moment when he says, like, I know you said the numbers, and I said them too. And he just said, like, he doesn't, like, make it a huge reveal. He doesn't say it in a dramatic fashion. He's just talking to her.
It's a kind of understated that most Doctor Who performers, past, present, future, can't do. Not because they're not good actors, but because those performances just aren't modulated to those places.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, David Tennant, I love David Tennant, great Doctor. He couldn't do that scene because his Doctor doesn't exist on that wavelength. Peter Capaldi can go that quiet and that vulnerable and hurt and small, kind of.
Yeah.
And it's terrifying in a totally different way.
Yeah, and it's something that scene sells so much about the relationship between the Doctor and Bill, and how different it is from, like, you know, because the only other companion this Doctor has had is Clara. And this episode highlights for me just how different Bill and Clara are, because you just, like, trying to run through that episode in your head with, like, Clara replaced for Bill. Like, Clara is the character that, where, like, Nardole pieces out of the episode. That's, Clara would have done that. Like, Clara would have figured it out at that point, been like, what is behind this projector? Oh, God, I'm not real, and have evaporated. But Bill is such a sort of, like, innocent, vulnerable character that, like, she's very curious about things, but I think she also, like, understands that curiosity has a cost in some ways, and, like, is not willing to go as far as Clara was willing to go.
Because she's a normal, sane person.
Exactly. She's a much more normal person, and so, but she needs that talk from the Doctor to sort of, like, process what is happening, and I think it says so much about, like, where the Doctor has come, that he's in a place to sort of give that talk in a way that also, if you think about, like, season 8, 12th Doctor, would probably not have been able to sort of talk to someone that way and, like, be that gentle. And that, like, it's just one of the most sort of touching scenes I've seen in Doctor Who, between the Doctor and the companion. Like, that just little conversation they have.
Touching and terrifying.
Yes.
Like, that's the thing with a lot of his relationship with Bill, is Bill would get along swimmingly with 10 or 11, you know? Like, they would be perfect for each other. But there is something about, she has met the Doctor at a profoundly dark place in his life. And I don't think it's a coincidence that this is also the episode where we get the flashbacks, which we have to talk about, because that tells us why he is in, or part of why he is in such a profoundly dark place. Like, this should be the companion relationship where they just go out and have fun. And really, we haven't had that. And there's a reason we haven't had that. They've had moments of that. But every story ultimately has had this. This has been a profoundly dark season of Doctor Who in a lot of different ways. And it really feels like this could be a companion exit where she just flees for her life, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's like, you are amazing, Doctor. You know, I want to be your friend, but this is not healthy for anybody. I'm out of here. Like an angry version of Martha's exit from season 3.
Right.
You know? Which I've always found kind of an interesting companion exit, because it's so, she just is self-motivated to leave. I feel like you could get that with Bill, and it could be really sad, but also right in a lot of ways. And this is one of those where it's like, yeah, what happens there, you're right. It is kind of a tender, interesting moment, but it's also, it's scary on so many levels, because I was still in that moment. I had no idea what the hell was going on with this episode.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, okay, there is some kind of large simulacrum going on. Is Stephen Moffat going, the entire universe is this way? Is this like a Matrix moment where we're going to fundamentally change the show and we're going to suddenly be in Zion and Lawrence Fishburne is going to be the next companion? Which would be great.
Oh, man. The Doctor in, like, the Matrix universe and, like, waking up, the way he would fuck around in that universe would be so amazing.
It really would be. But anyway, like, you know, is that where we're going? Is this just like a dream sequence? Is it something in between? Is it neither? Like, there are so many questions up in the air, and it's so fundamentally terrifying. And the way the Doctor lays it all out, which is a pretty, like, bleak layout of what's going on. It's not, here's the situation, Bill, and here's how I'm going to save us. Which is what most doctors, including Peter Capaldi 2 years ago, might have said. But he's not there right now, you know, and it's just, that whole scene is just, it shakes you so hard. And even though it has kind of a triumphant finish when the monks come in and all that, you've been through, like, you've seen Nardole and Bill basically die, and now you see the doctor, you know, his plan is just, I'm going to hopefully, you know, email this to my real self, and maybe something will come of it. It's such a bizarre, wonderful ending to an episode.
Yeah, because there also is just this unbelievable sense of hopelessness in that White House scene where, like, you realize, like, for sure all of this is fake, where, like, no matter what happens, like, this version of the doctor can't exist anymore. Like, these characters that we have been following for this whole episode cannot exist, and you have to, like, jump out of the Matrix at some point. Like, even if somehow this was an episode that resolved, like, the monster conflict in itself, and, like, somehow fake Doctor defeated them, like, that story would just end with him having to fucking kill himself, right? Because he can't exist. And there's just a sense of, no matter what happens, this character cannot survive as they are anymore. And that's just such a, like you said, it's a very bleak, dark thing for a show to do, because most TV shows can't go to that place, because TV shows are built on, like, the fundamental understanding that these characters are going to continue to exist for the duration of the TV show. And so it's like, you don't usually get an episode where you feel like, oh, right, yes, there's no way that any of these characters can survive.
You also, most TV shows have delineated lines of reality.
That is also true. That's a good point.
And you have no delineated lines of reality here. So let's talk about the flashbacks.
Okay, yeah.
Because that's a really interesting sequence, because you could have put these in a different episode, but, you know, because there's not, like, a heavy literal connection going on.
Yeah.
But I find the thematic connection so interesting, and I think the pace it gives the episode, where we kind of keep going back to whatever this kind of original sin is in the current Doctor's life, it's really, really interesting. And I was it just me, or was Michelle Gomez more interesting in her performance than kind of ever here?
Yeah, like, I just think she gets better every single time she shows up. Like, she's settled into the role really well.
Yeah, and that's not me dissing her other appearances. It's just, I was kind of surprised at how interesting I found that character, even though it's a brief appearance.
Yeah.
It's not, she does a lot. She's mostly kneeling, waiting to die. But it's an interesting shading, and her and Capaldi have a really interesting chemistry at this point.
Yeah, I think they have done, even if, like, a lot of her stuff in season 8 was sort of, you know, fumbled or mixed, however you want to sort of look at it, they have done, I think, a very good job at this point establishing the relationship between the Doctor and the Master, and really kind of going back to basics with it, that you do get this sense of, like, the Third Doctor, Roger Delgado Master, like, the original appearance of that character in that relationship, more of, like, you know, Sierra the Master is like, ha 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 ha, I have the goatee and the black shirt, and I'm killing people, and he kills people by shrinking them, which is always hilarious at the old Master appearances. And he's like, he's hatching these master plans and schemes, and then he's executing on them and being, like, sinister while he does it. But you always got this sense of, like, a playfulness of it with the character, and of, like, there is this past relationship with him and the Doctor that they used to be, or maybe still are, friends. And it's kind of hard not to watch the scene. I forget which serial it's from. I think it might be The Sea Devils. It's a brilliant scene where John Pertwee, the Third Doctor, and Roger Delgado Master sword fight with, like, friends and coils with each other. And it's just like, you get that sense of, like, the Master gets to be dastardly and have fun being dastardly because the Doctor's around, and the Doctor gets to be dashing and heroic because the Master's around. And, like, in some ways they do have, like, opposing ideological points of view, but at the same time those opposing ideological points of view feed off of each other and, like, make each other, like, help each other have fun and play around. And they, so, like, even when, you know, you definitely get this sense of, like, a real, like, severe ideological rift when the Master does something really awful, like killing people, you still, I feel like, believe in that friendship. And you did with the Third Doctor stuff, and I feel like they have found that place again after a very long time and a lot of hard work of, like, you know, even though I like a lot of the later Master appearances in classic Doctor Who, they never got back to that level that Delgado had. And it feels like, Delgado is probably still always going to be, for me, the best Master, because just, like, so is that character. But this is the closest they've ever gotten and, like, really found that interesting space in the relationship again to allow this really small appearance from her and still, like, get that relationship across in a way that if they had completely just, like, messed that up entirely in Series 8, they would not have been able to get to this point.
Yeah, and it also so much relies on, you know, it's not just Delgado, it's the Pertwee side of it, yeah. right? That it's the Master and the Doctor and kind yes. of how they play off each other. And, you know, like Michelle Gomez has said, she's not going to play the Master once Capaldi is gone. And I completely see her reasoning. It's like, yeah. that performance feeds off Capaldi's performance and vice versa. And that relationship is what makes it. And I actually think it's kind of at its best here in this episode where... You know, we have not really seen the Doctor at this point before where he's just full on, I'm going to kill the Master. Like, yeah. this is, I'm going to execute her in this case. the gender pronouns get difficult. But, like, you know, and it's this really interesting planet where it feels like it could be its own episode, but it's not, where there's this execution planet, and they're going to have the body in a box for 1,000 years and all this stuff. And I actually really, this is a flashback, but it's not all that expository, because yeah. we don't know what the Master did to get here, and we don't really know why the Doctor feels this hopeless about the situation that he's prepared to do this. And I like that we get to just read that in the performances. And I actually hope we don't learn more about that.
Yeah.
Like, it's better if it's ambiguous. Because the last time we saw Missy, she had, like, taken over a Dalek ship. I like to just imagine no good could come from that.
Yeah.
And the Doctor just, maybe something happened that was a step too far. And he's willing to, like, consider this. And it's a really interesting progression of scenes where you have Nardole come with River Song's notebook, which is yeah. a really good full circle from... God, so many years ago now when Stephen Moffat introduced River Song yeah. in the notebook with, you know, David Tennant Doctor, who has not been Doctor for a very long time.
Yeah.
And, you know, he reads that bit from the notebook and the Doctor, it's not even like a literal one-to-one connection either of why that is what shakes him out of it, but he chooses, like, I'm not going to kill her, I'm going to keep her prisoner.
Yeah.
And you see basically the Doctor... I don't know if he did the right thing. I don't know if he did the wrong thing. And he doesn't know either.
Yeah.
And it's a really interesting state to be in. And then, you know, you keep having these flashbacks also to what is the actual text of the episode, frankly, which is him sitting in front of the vault while he gets that email and just feeling so small and alone in all of this because he really just doesn't know what to do.
Yeah. And it's something where you get this sense of, like, the Doctor is... I think there's something about, like, having... Missy there in the vault, like, right there all the time, like, just on the other side of this door is this weird temptation for him. And that, like, you know, he has this other person that's right there that, like, knows him and, like, knows everything about him that he grew up with, that, like, is another person that is the same member of the species that he is. And you get that sense of, like, how lonely of a character the Doctor is most of the time, that, you know, some different interpretations of the Doctor have played up that element more than others. But it is a constant feature ever since, like, the William Hartnell days, especially after Susan leaves, of, like, he's the only person among all these characters that is an alien. Like, he's, no matter what happens, he doesn't entirely fit in wherever he is. And having that character on the other side of that door as a temptation, and you can so understand why... And, like, I guess it was the end of Knock Knock, where he's, like, really giddy about it and goes down and, like, you hear the piano and he brings, like, Mexican food or whatever it is. Like, you can see why he's like that, because it's like he has this other person that he can engage with on a level he just can't with Bill. Like, no matter how, like, great a companion Bill is in both the sense of, like, the show and, like, the actual meaning of the word, she can't have, like, share those experiences that the Doctor could share with Missy.
And there is just such this sadness about it in that... Yeah, the Doctor is being fairly irresponsible with all this
yes.
when all is said and done. And he knows it. And Nardole really knows it. But it's like, yes, it's kind of like the Batman-Joker thing. At a certain point, Batman probably should just sacrifice a little bit of his integrity because he keeps the Joker alive and a lot of people die. And here it's like, you know, maybe the Doctor didn't need to kill Bill or whatever. Not Bill. That'd be a Quentin Tarantino movie.
Yeah.
Kill Missy or the Master.
That'd be a real dark episode of Doctor Who if he killed Bill.
That's the finale. Kill Bill parts 1 and 2.
Kill Bill part 3.
Yeah.
Tarantino was talking about it for years.
He's directing Doctor Who finally. Yeah. No. But now he has the Master in this vault on his own. He didn't go find a prison planet for her. And he just has her there. It's both sadistic and childlike in that he kind of just wants, as you say, that... friend, enemy, you know, there in the vault so he can always access it, but not, he can kind of take it out to play, but he can be safe in the knowledge that, okay, she can't get out or whatever, even though that's not all that safe an assumption. And all of that is just kind of, it really does, it makes you not know how to feel about this whole situation, because you can't blame the Doctor for his emotions, but his actions are pretty out of line at this point.
Yeah.
Because, one, what he's doing to the Master is fairly inhumane,
yes.
and there's that level of it. It's dangerous, And it's not emotionally healthy for anyone.
Yeah.
You know? And maybe he had... And it also feels like maybe he did have this hope of like, oh, maybe I can rehabilitate. But he doesn't seem to be trying that much anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, one of the things Michelle Gomez does really well, especially when I think the scripts let her do this, is she can play those calm moments where you really want to believe what she's saying. But you, there's just this little element of it where it's like, of course she's lying through her teeth. The master's not going to just become a good person because she doesn't want to die, you know? We've seen this. This show's 50 years old.
Yeah. I have seen the master supposedly die a lot, and the master always comes back, and the master is always just as bad as the last time.
And it is such a great setup for the rest of this season, because the master has been the defining villain of the Capaldi years, basically, in a way the master has not been ever in Modern Who.
Yeah.
And, you know, it does feel like for Capaldi's last season to be... This is obviously going to build to a confrontation with the master... Two of them, because we know John Sim is going to be in this.
Yeah.
And it feels like that is an emotional bridge this doctor has to cross, not because of the master's importance, but because of, I think, what it symbolically represents for the doctor at this point in the story, you know?
Yeah. And it's just coming together in such a way that I think you can definitely understand on another level, maybe, like, why Peter Capaldi would want to leave at this point. It does feel like there's a coming full circle-ness of bringing the master in and having her be important in this way, in the way that, like, you know, that's season 8. Like, that's how that relationship was. And it's something that it, even, like, as much as it's, like, bums me out to think about him leaving the show, like, this season has been so good that I think it, like, hopefully I will be able to accept it reasonably well when the time comes.
There also has been a sense of finality. Like, frankly, if he announced it around now, I would feel like, okay, I kind of get it, you know? It was much more of a question mark before the season aired. Kind of like, and very much kind of like what it was with Matt Smith, where it's like, and that literally was, they weren't done, you know?
Yeah.
But it does feel like here, he can kind of go out on top, and Moffat can go out on top, and just say they, I think, told the best story they could, and that's all that really matters.
Yeah.
But this was a interesting episode.
Yeah.
I mean, so... This really rewrites, I think, our expectations for the rest of the season, because we've had a pretty episodic run of Doctor Who so far. This story is clearly continuing in some form, and then we're going to have the stuff with the Master going on. You know, I'm really curious to see what happens, and we've got 6 episodes left. Where does this go?
Yeah, one of the big questions is, does, at the end of the next episode, is the Doctor's blindness cured? Because the next episode, like, really interestingly, the next episode is sort of co-written by Stephen Moffat and Peter Harness, who's the Kill the Moon / Zygon Invasion, Zygon Inversion guy, which is the nicer way to refer to him is the Zygon Invasion / Zygon Inversion guy from last season.
Yeah.
And that's, like, an interesting split, having them both co-writing, and, like, since that's the last episode that Stephen Moffat has a writing credit on until, like, the finales... I think, like, next episode feels like is kind of probably their last opportunity to cure the blindness, unless they're going all the way with it.
There is a not insignificant chance they're going all the way with it.
Yeah, I really have no idea. Like, I can kind of see both ways of it. Because part of me wants them to just go all the way with it and just be like, that's fucking crazy that over half of a season of Doctor Who was spent with the Doctor blinded. Like, that's so nuts. The other part of me is like, this is Peter Capaldi's last season, and I don't know if I want him, like, to never have old Peter Capaldi, like visioned up 12th Doctor, not ever having that character come back is such a sad idea to me, that, like, this is the state he's going to be in until he regenerates is so sad. I don't know which way I want it to go.
I don't know. There's also in all the season 10, like, previews and stuff, there's those little hints of a regeneration-like event happening.
Yeah.
It obviously can't be his full regeneration unless they've been lying to us about a lot of things.
Yeah.
But, like, is it going to be a, like, that thing that happened with the 10th Doctor in the season 4 finale where he partially regenerates?
Yeah, and he makes a Doctor clone or whatever with his severed hand, which is one of the weirder plot points in Doctor Who history.
And then the Doctor clone gets to go marry Rose on an alternate planet and do it.
Yeah, that's where it felt like Doctor Who for a little bit in the main series turned into a Doctor Who spin-off comic book.
Yeah, or just a fan fiction on an erotic fan board.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, anyway, but, like, is it like the regeneration starts and then something really weird happens and it takes 6 episodes to happen?
Yeah.
You know, like, where are we going with this? There are so many possibilities. Even if it does, the blindness thing wraps up next week, it is such a crazy, audacious thing that they did.
Yeah. No, and it's something that... It has added a really cool element of continuity between the episodes, and I feel like I'm really excited for the end of this season to be able to look back on how the whole thing was structured. Because, you know, we had the first, like, three episodes, really, were all one contiguous story that, like, did not, you know, the plots weren't interconnected, but they led basically directly into one another.
Like old Doctor Who serials.
Yes, like old Doctor Who serials. And episode four was kind of like a little standalone thing. But then Oxygen, that now leads through the blindness, is, like, directly connected to, in, like, thematic ways, this episode. Obviously, next episode is him fighting, like, the mummies or whatever they are. And in a way that I love, it feels like the kind of how they handled season 9 of, it's a two-part story, but each part feels like it is fully fulfilled and stands on its own in such a way that, like, you would never... Like, I would not put this as, like, part one and part two. Presumably, like, who knows how, like, maybe the next episode will be structured in such a way I don't entirely feel that way. But it feels more like how, like, The Girl Who Died and The Woman Who Lived, that clearly they are connected episodes, and you would see why they are right next to each other. But also, like, again, if this episode did not, if the next episode had nothing to do with the plot of this episode, I would just, like, roll with it and be like, that was a fucking weird episode of Doctor Who, but I can just imagine that the Doctor saw, like, won the day off screen, and we can just proceed with the season as normal.
Yeah, but I'm very excited to see where they go with it. It's going to be a pyramid. That's interesting. Yes,
Pyramid at the End of the World.
I like that title.
It's a very good
That
title.
Sounds like a Doctor Who book that I would get in Barnes & Noble.
Exactly.
But and that's not a diss. Some of those books are kind of fun.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's Doctor Who.
Yes, it was. Man.
That was an episode. Deep breath, Sean.
No, that was from season 8.
No, Sean. Deep breath, because we need to talk about Twin Peaks.
Again, we talked about Twin Peaks for like 5 hours, like a week ago, Jonathan.
There's new Twin Peaks.
What?
And it's even weirder than old Twin Peaks.
Oh, God!
Yeah.
Yeah, it is!
It is!
Yeah, we both spent 4 hours watching Twin Peaks last night.
Okay, then that's the question I have to start with.
Uh-huh.
We were both planning on, probably around the time it aired live, watching the 2-hour premiere, right?
Yeah.
Were you planning to watch all 4 in one sitting?
No.
I was not. I thought I might, but I was also thinking, like, I could save those.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to wait until next week, but...
Yeah, because, I mean, it came on pretty late. Like, it started airing at, like, 8 or not 7?
7 was, yeah.
So it was, like, 9 o'clock, and it was like, well, either it's... Like, if I decide to start watching the next episode of Twin Peaks, that is all I am doing for the rest of the night. There's no way I'm doing anything else. You have to commit or not. And I really committed.
Really, the only break I took was I was watching this on my Apple TV. I have Showtime through PlayStation View, and I watched the premiere live on that. And then I realized I didn't have the Showtime app, so the longest break was downloading the Showtime app. And that was it. And then I was into episodes 3 and 4, and it only got better from there.
Oh, yeah, it did.
Oh, my God. Okay.
Man.
Man. All right. Spoilers from here on out. If you have not seen The Return of Twin Peaks, hours 1, 2, 3, and 4, just do that. You know?
Yeah.
Take whatever hallucinogen of your choice if you want to. It really won't make a difference. And sit down for some TV.
Is it TV?
I don't know.
It ends with movie credits. It ends, like, each episode literally ends with credits that have text in it referring to it as a film and a motion picture.
That's just standard copyright stuff.
But it's movie credits. They're not, it's, in a way that it feels like somehow David Lynch thought that that's how every episode of original Twin Peaks ended, was with credits like that in the bar, and that's not how it happened. In the way that, like, you know, the opening credits are, like, clearly modeled after the opening credits of Twin Peaks, and it has the same song and same font and all that stuff, and then it's like they go to the bar at the end of each episode with a different band playing a song as movie-style credits come up. It's like, what the fuck?
It is, yeah, it's not a movie, it's not TV, it's David Lynch.
Yeah.
You know how the HBO used to have that slogan, it's not TV, it's HBO?
Yeah.
It's not TV, it's whatever David Lynch and Mark Frost want to do at this exact moment.
Yes, it is the new designer drug on the street, it is Twin Peaks.
I loved this so much.
Yes.
I finished this at, as you say, at least, it would have to have at least been 11 p.m., maybe later, because again, I had to take the install break, which was really the only break, and I was just giddy for the rest of the night. I couldn't go to bed until like 2 a.m. I dreamed about it. I woke up still thinking about it. I've been distracted doing other things. It's just, that was unlike anything I have ever seen on my TV.
Yeah.
Even other David Lynch things.
Uh-huh.
It feels like he climbed the mountain, he attained some form of enlightenment, and he's not sharing it with the rest of us, but he's giving us a little taste of it.
Yeah. And it's, man, it was such a, like, weird experience of, like, even just before watching it, where I had this weird moment of, like, trepidation or, like, anxiety or something, where I was, like, looking at Twitter a little bit before it aired and, like seeing kind of how, like, people were, like, everyone sitting down and getting ready to watch it. And I just had all these thoughts about, like, oh, right, like, David Lynch hasn't really made anything in, like, 10 years. It's like, that's a long time to be away from this stuff. And it's like, and I realized, like, the most modern David Lynch thing I've even watched was Mulholland Drive, and I watched that a couple of days ago. It's like, what if he's lost it? What if it's not good? Like, what, it, like, I just had all of these, like, I just felt really insecure for, like, the 10 minutes before it started airing in a way I was not expecting at all. I got, like, really afraid that it would be bad, and how, like, how much it would hurt if 18 hours of television directed by David Lynch were bad. It would just devastate me.
Or, like, for me, it was just we hadn't seen literally anything from this. Like, I think we have a clip somewhere of Hawk saying, mm-hmm, from, like, one of the trailers, yeah. But that's it. Like, we knew nothing about this. We didn't know who would be in the premiere, what would be in the premiere. We knew nothing about this project, and you never go in cold to something like that anymore. Ever, under any circumstances, do you go this cold into something. And so there was that kind of natural trepidation I think you're describing, but also, like, I want to know what this is.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. After 2 hours, maybe 3 and 4 hours, I don't know, I didn't know what it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All I knew was I needed more of it.
Yeah. I feel like after episode three really put it in perspective in a way that, like, I'm just going to call it episode one, because calling it episodes one and two is just too much of a mouthful. So like, because it is one episode of television. Like, they did not... There's no split in the middle between episodes one and two or whatever.
They did on the app. It's got a slightly different ending sequence.
Oh, okay.
Where it doesn't have a bar thing, but what they did is the scene where it cuts, which it's just a cut, and you would just, in the actual episode, you cut to the next scene. It goes back to the giant in the black and white lodge, and it kind of zooms into this gramophone over his shoulder, and that's where the credits show up. It's kind of a fun little thing, but yeah, it's supposed to be a 2-hour episode, obviously.
Yeah. So, like, episode one was so weird, like, so, but not in the way, like, not in a normal David Lynchy way.
No.
All the time, like, in a way that, like, let's just put it this way, this is the return of Twin Peaks. The first three scenes, if I can remember, like, the exact order of them, were you have Dale Cooper with the giant in the lodge and, like, talking about nonsense. Then it cuts to the therapist from Twin Peaks,
Dr. Jacoby,
like, in the middle of the forest, presumably at Twin Peaks, getting a shipment of shovels delivered to him with, like, in a scene that's shot from so far away that you can't make out any of the dialogue. And then it cuts to New York fucking City. Like, the third scene, like, the first two scenes don't make any sense. And the third scene of the new Twin Peaks is in New York City, in, like, an apartment high-rise building where some random kid is sitting on a fucking couch watching a glass box that is getting filmed from, like, 7 different angles by cameras, and in the glass box is a little circular window to the city skyline of New York City. And that's, like, 10 minutes of the episode is just those three scenes. And nothing happens in the one with the kid. You just see him change the fucking memory stick on a camera, and then he talks to the one girl who's, like, in season one of Californication, which is the oldest season of Californication I ever saw.
Deep cut, Sean.
Deep cuts.
No. But also starring David Duchovny, who appeared in episode 4 of New Twin Peaks.
Exactly,
in a glorious scene.
Yes.
No. I mean, here's a good one or two sentence review of New Twin Peaks.
Uh-huh.
The vast majority of it does not take place in Twin Peaks.
Yes.
And somehow that feels appropriate.
Yes.
It is this, I mean, that's honestly one of the biggest things I want to start with.
Uh-huh.
Is that this is called Twin Peaks. It's not old Twin Peaks. It is not, like, when Gilmore Girls or The X-Files came back, and you're like, yeah, this is a little different, but it's more Gilmore Girls or The X-Files.
Yeah.
This is a different show. It's got similar things, but it is, like, it's not, you know, episode 31 of Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
It is its own fucking thing. It moves at a different pace. It has a pretty different visual style. It has a different writing style in places. It is so its own glorious creation, even in the larger Lynch canon. He's never really made anything quite like this, because on one hand, it has the kind of freeform jazz experimentation of Inland Empire, which is basically 3 hours of Lynch doing whatever the fuck he wants to do.
Great.
And you can follow it if you want or not, but he's doing it. But it's also cohesive. Like, there is a narrative going on here. Yeah. It extends directly from the end of old Twin Peaks. And it is a surprisingly linear narrative. Like, relative to normal Lynchian conventions, it makes sense. Like, scene to scene, there is a logic to the progression of the story, even if there isn't always a logic of, like, why is Jacoby getting the shovels the second scene of the return? Like, what's the second scene of the Twin Peaks pilot? It's, I think, like Sheriff Truman getting the call that there's a dead body, right?
Yeah.
Like, that makes sense. It makes no sense why some scenes are where they are, but there is a progression where there is linearity and there is continuity, but it also has that freeform jazz kind of thing that he did in Inland Empire, and I didn't know those things could work together, but they do, and it's beautiful.
Yeah.
Because you never know what was going to happen. Like, that was the biggest thing in these four episodes, is how consistently surprising I found them. Every time I thought I knew what was going to happen, it very, very much did not.
Yes.
Like, everyone thought Cooper was going to appear in the box, right?
Yeah.
He does not appear in the box, at least at first. What appears in the box is scary.
Very scary.
And then later on, Cooper appears in the box flying like Peter Pan, and then he just leaves after it becomes
he
like
he does a, not just leave. You cannot describe that as someone leaving. Yeah. He, like, a fucking, like, reality just, like, closes in on him as he gets shot away in, like, concentric squares of the frame that just shoot into, like, the infinite distance, and then he disappears from reality, and then you find out that that actually happened, like, before the earlier scene take place where the kids are killed, so they just miss seeing Agent Cooper by, like, 3 minutes.
And it doesn't connect to that scene either, because you thought maybe that's a lead up to the ghost, but it's not. Like, throughout episodes 3 and 4, I kept thinking, okay, Cooper is in a vegetative state, but something is going to knock him out of it. Okay, this thing he's going to hear. No, okay, now he's drinking coffee. That's going to... No, nothing I think is going to happen is going to happen. Like, okay, clearly the prostitute is driving him away from the house. He's not going to come back here. No, he's coming back here, and Naomi fucking Watts is his wife.
Yeah.
They're doing this.
Uh-huh.
It is so...
Well, she's not his wife. She's Dougie's wife.
She's Dougie's wife.
Let's be precise. Dougie Jones.
Let's be as precise as we can.
Owner of a yellow sports jacket and a green sports jacket. And I'm so sad that Dougie Jones got, like, exorcised into the Red Room or whatever the fuck happened to him. Because I want to know more about Dougie Jones because he seemed amazing.
Why he has a son named Sonny Jim?
Why he's married to Naomi Watts, and yet still he feels compelled to go out with a prostitute in some, like, random, like, house that I guess nobody owns.
Yeah, that's...
Where all of his, like, crippling debt comes from. Like, what the fuck is up with Dougie Jones' life? And his wife.
Okay, how do we cohere this conversation?
It's not possible.
I mean, even for... David Lynch has never gone anywhere quite near the line of metaphysics he did last night. Like... Mm-hmm. Twin Peaks had its magical realism, which we've talked about. Like, there's little flirtations with other dimensions. In the episodes we saw last night, Agent Dale Cooper came out of an electrical socket.
Yeah, he did.
He went to space.
Yes, he did.
He flew to New York City.
Yeah.
A lot happened to these people. Kyle MacLachlan is playing two separate characters, one of whom vomited up the alien from Alien, apparently.
He played three separate characters. We cannot forget about Dougie Jones.
This is very true. I mean, and you could even consider, like, Cooper in the Lodge versus the vegetative Cooper different. Like, this went just full on metaphysical fuck job, right? Or mind fuck. Like, what was that?
I don't know. But yeah, so let's, like, because it's for me, I don't know what your experience like watching, like, the pilot, or like part one, part two, episode one, however the fuck you call it. The premiere episode, and then moving into episodes 3 and 4, because I was like, I was definitely incredibly intrigued by the premiere episode, especially like everything that was not Twin Peaks I loved. Like everything in New York City and South Dakota, I thought like, this shit is so good. It's so amazing. But like the couple of scenes that took place in Twin Peaks that like you sort of hinted at that stuff, and the stuff in the Red Room did not fully convince me. Like there's something about the Red Room in the premiere basically like serves as like an expositionary device in a weird way. Like the dialogue in there is much more sort of cogent than it's ever been in
while coming out of a brain on a tree.
Keep this in mind. I did also watch this like 2 days after I watched Mulholland Drive for the first time. So like, it's like filling a fucking brain on a tree. That doesn't even register as weird to me. Okay. So it's like, That's nothing. Like, Brain on a Tree, I can accept that. I don't even notice it, really. What the Brain on the Tree was telling Dale Cooper was, like really sort of, yes. like, normal exposition or dialogue about, like, he's not in here, like, you need to leave, you need to bring him back. Like, and it's just, like, telling you about, like, yes, you, like, Bob has left. Bob, like the ending of season 2 of Twin Peaks is what you thought it was. Like, Bob has occupied Dale Cooper's body. Dale Cooper is trapped in the Red Room. Like, evil Dale Cooper has been going around the world for fucking 25 years, kicking ass, taking name, fucking people in two different ways, and it's so good. As he goes around with a huge briefcase that has a tiny little Microsoft Surface in it, and we will talk about that scene in detail when we get there. But we have evil Dale Cooper's been going around killing people, like, dealing drugs, all that shit, while normal Dale Cooper has been trapped in the Red Room. And all the dialogue about that stuff was, like, so on the nose. I was like, this is really weird. Like, this is a weird thing, a weird choice to make. To have, like, everything that is about, like, the Twin Peaks as Twin Peaks part of the reboot of Twin Peaks felt like so much of just, like, a one-note continuation of the stuff that happened at the end of season 2 in terms of, like, the plot. And, but then you have all this other crazy shit going on with the room in New York City and the weird, like, police investigation in South Dakota with, like, the school principal and all that shit is amazing. I was like, I don't know how I feel about the thing as a whole because of that Red Room stuff. And then you watch the beginning of episode 3.
Yes.
And it's like, oh, the Red Room stuff was, like, on the nose and expository because David Lynch had a, like, secret trick in his back pocket, and that was the Red Room is, like, your baseline. That's where you start, is the Red Room for Twin Peaks, and you only go in more insane from there. And as soon as episode 3 starts and he ends up in the fucking, like, exhaust vent in space, where he gets sucked through, like, a weird thing on the wall that first had the number 15 on it, and then the number 3, and the dedication to just put random meaningless numbers everywhere in the first 4 episodes of Twin Peaks. I love to death. And he just gets sucked through it, and then, like, in a scene 10 minutes later, you see him materialize through a fucking outlet in the wall.
Yeah. I had a very similar experience.
Yeah.
I think the premiere is a great thing, whatever it is.
Yeah.
But at the time, yeah, there is this whiplash because it's exactly what I was describing before. This is Lynch weirder than ever, but also there is a story going on.
Yeah.
And, like, I think through these 4, I'm so glad Showtime put all 4 out.
Yes.
Because the 4 episodes, once you get to the end of episode 4, I have no idea where this is going, but I have a very good sense that Mark Frost and David Lynch do.
Yes.
And that this is a story with multiple pieces that they are taking their sweet fucking time telling,
yeah.
but they are telling it. That, like, there is a reason we went to South Dakota and New York City, and that these are not random places, that this will all cohere, that we're in Las Vegas, that Naomi Watts is playing Dougie Jones's wife. All of this is happening for some reason, and I also think, like, the town of Twin Peaks has a reason, because it's the place, ultimately, this journey is trying to return to.
Yeah.
And there's, as Lynch really likes in his 21st century career, there's a meta-narrative going on, I think, with that, too,
yeah.
you know, obviously. But, like, yeah, the stuff in the Red Room is, it's really weird, obviously. You got a brain on a stick and all that stuff. Weirdly, Mike the One-Armed Man is in this more than any other Twin Peaks alum other than Kyle MacLachlan.
Yeah.
But, and maybe Hawk. Hawk is in it a lot.
Yeah.
But, you know, not exactly the A-list, like, first characters you think of when you think of Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
Not to say that Hawk isn't awesome, because I love that
Hawk
guy.
Is amazing. I love his more prominent role in these episodes. It's really good. It's
fantastic. But no, like, there's a reason you're there, and that's because you're setting up what the struggle of this story is, which is Dale Cooper has been gone for 25 years.
Yeah.
He's been stuck in that fucking room, and he has to get back. And it's actually, part of what's so off-putting is how simple it actually boils down to.
Yeah.
It's presented as weird as possible, obviously.
Yeah.
But there is a clear linearity. Like, there is a motivation to the storytelling that kind of starts connecting all these dots that is very, very interesting. And the web does kind of get more complex as we go, but it's also, you can start seeing the strings connecting the web, and it is not just a random act of Lynch, you know? There is so much more going on here. But in those first 2 episodes, I don't think I saw that.
Mm-hmm,
and yeah. I think I was like, I exactly like you. The New York scenes are phenomenal. That is one of the best horror scenes I've ever seen in my life. Is the stuff with the box. It's amazing. And the duration of it is what makes it so amazing, frankly.
Yeah.
And those 2 actors, who sadly we will not see again, although who knows, it's Twin Peaks, they were great, you know, just kind of the Californication lady, as you said.
Yes.
I don't know her. Apparently the other guy was in Boardwalk Empire, so, you know, we got our the cable TV credits on there. But no, that was amazing. The South Dakota stuff was extremely intriguing. But there was also kind of this sense of, like, discomfort of, like, okay, when are we going to get to the story? Or, like, what's the center of this? Or, like, when do we see Twin Peaks characters or whatever? Yeah. I don't know what I was I tried to go in with as few expectations as possible, but it's inevitable that you're kind of, like, trying to search for the core of whatever it is. And I couldn't find that, and by the end of the 2 hours, I really enjoyed it because, number one, the filmmaking last night was out of this world good in a lot of places. I mean, that Lynch has not lost his fastball. He's kind of gotten better in some ways. Yeah. And so you have all of that. I was definitely on board, but I was just like, I don't know what this is yet. I don't know what this is. And so it was like, episode three's right there. I'm not gonna go to bed and not know what this is. Yeah. I have to keep trying. And if after three or four episodes I still don't know what this is, at least I'll know I don't know what this is. But I had to keep going, and exactly like you, episode three blew the back of my mind off and rewired my brain.
Yeah.
That is an amazing hour of television, or whatever this is.
Mm-hmm.
And those first 20, 30 minutes in particular, in wherever we were, I mean, that's the closest thing to Eraserhead Lynch has ever done since Eraserhead.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely on par for me with, like, the titular Eraserhead sequence from that movie where you go through the eraser factory. Like,
yeah.
It is so bizarre, it is so funny, it is so dark, it is so beautiful, it is so horrifying, and all of those things exist in complete and utter tandem with one another. And then the back half of the episode was Cooper in the casino, which is one of the single funniest things I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, just, like, the whole, like, the idea that you could say Twin Peaks came back, okay, like, you saw the first four episodes, well, what did the main character Dale Cooper do? Well, he was stuck in the Red Room for a while. Then he was in, like, a floating, like, big exhaust thing, you know, that are, like, the top of apartment buildings mostly, and he kind of was on there, and then he went outside, and he was in space, and the floating head came by and said Blue Rose, and then he went back in, and then he got sucked through an electrical socket and replaced another doppelganger of his that got sucked into the Red Room. And then he just walked around a casino for about an hour and a half, pulling levers and getting jackpots to the point where a homeless lady started referring to him as Mr. Jackpot. And then he started referring to himself as Mr. Jackpot.
And you're the best part of going, yes!
No, he goes, hello!
Right.
And then every time he gets the jackpot, he has the same, like, like, really, like, frightened reaction. He's so startled by it every single time it goes on. And all the people in the casino are just like, walking, just like, oh, God, where is he? Is he over there? Oh, no, like, they're running around with all these huge buckets trying to get all of his quarters. It's so, so bizarre. It's so good. And, like, one of, like, the most, like, Lynchiest sort of, like, elements of filmmaking that he has maintained so steadfast, I think, is probably if there's one thing that will turn people off from this, like, more than anything else, I think is, like, the glacial pacing.
Oh, it's so slow.
It's so slow, but it's so perfect. It's not like, you know, I have an issue with a lot of, like, you know, 45-minute long television episodes that, like, tend to have, you know, like, or, like, the, like, Netflix TV series, like, have that, like, issue of, like, some episodes just, like, are so long and so feel so slow because there's no, like, thematic coherence or anything. Here, it just takes forever because David Lynch just loves to say, like, we're just going to do 5 minutes of this asshole sitting on a bench and spray painting these shovels gold. And that's this whole scene. If there's no line of dialogue, no other character enters, there's no, like, explicit piece of information provided to you in this entire five-minute scene other than that Dr. Jacoby is spray-painting these shovels he got in the pilot gold.
I really do have a hope deep down that that's, like, one thing that does not cohere with anything else.
And I hope that the twist is, like, we find out, like, five episodes later that he just, like, buys shovels, spray paints them gold, and sells them for a little bit more than he bought them. And that's, like, that's how he, like, makes his living or something, and that's all it is.
I hope that's it. And it's just a little sub-narrative going on in the background that Lynch found funny enough to make the second scene of the revival.
Yeah.
No, you're absolutely right. Yeah, that is the thing to talk about. The absolutely glacial pace. And look, there are a lot of things that are going to turn people off about these episodes.
Yeah.
This is not the Twin Peaks you saw in 1990.
No.
This is, you know, because even though Twin Peaks is a deeply weird show and all that stuff, I do think it's a show that I could get a lot of people not normally interested in this kind of thing on board with.
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
There's a very clean hook. It takes a little while before the show gets actively weird. It's got a lot of characters you can easily latch onto and locations and stuff. It is a, you know, in structure, it's a fairly traditional TV show, and that's part of its, what makes it so perverse, you know, and, yeah, and subversive is what I'm trying to say. This is not anything like that. It is glacially slow. It is, it takes such joy in hitting the brakes and just letting things go at their own pace,
yeah,
and having pauses between the characters' lines and just letting scenes breathe and having a very distinct and precise sound design that is nevertheless often very, very quiet.
Yeah.
And yeah, I dug it to hell.
Mm-hmm.
I found it utterly riveting. Like, yeah, even when I didn't know what to think of things, I was on the edge of my seat. Like, yeah, I just could not wait to see where things were going. I was just so drawn in by it. Again, I watched 4 fucking hours of this thing in a, yeah, row, and I never once felt like I want to go do something else.
Yeah.
And I cannot wait for more. I'm sad when we're going to have only 1 hour a night.
Yeah.
That's not going to be nearly enough. Ugh. But yeah, like, it is glacially slow, and yet it makes those moments when things go cattywampus, as they are. I don't know what other word to use. It just makes them so much more powerful.
Yeah.
You know? Because you wait and you wait and you wait. And sometimes the waiting is the thing, because he is definitely doing an avant-garde film tradition of playing with duration. And that is what the shuffle scene is.
Yeah.
That is what, frankly, a lot of these scenes are. And I think they're fascinating and beautiful in that way. That's what a lot of the box stuff is, even though it does ultimately lead somewhere. Where it leads, I don't know. But it does ultimately lead somewhere. But then, yeah, you do have, you know, the duration so feeds into that box, you know, set piece where the teenagers, and again, it's David Lynch taking the most cliched thing he possibly can of two kids, you know, having sex where they shouldn't be having sex and getting killed for it.
Yeah.
And making it so utterly Lynchian, where it is slow, 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 where we have to have the whole scene of the guy watching the box. And then Tracy comes in, and he talks to Tracy, and they have this wonderful back and forth, where those actors were born to read Lynch dialogue.
Yeah.
And she gives him the coffee, and he's like, no, you can have both lattes and all this stuff. And you can tell, okay, Tracy wants to come in because she wants to be with this guy. You know, maybe they're together, maybe not, whatever. But then we get more of him watching and changing things out. And then he hears the elevator, and he goes out as Tracy again. But now the guard's not there. They don't know why the guard isn't there, so they go and check the bathroom. And then they come back in, and they start drinking their coffee. And one of my favorite moments is he gestures towards the couch. And instead of just stepping on the dais and going to the couch, he leads her to the two stairs.
Yeah.
And they go up the dais, and then they sit on the couch, because David Lynch is not going to let them just step onto the dais. Yeah. They're going to walk up the stairs. And then they sit there for a while, and then she starts, you know, kind of getting frisky with him, and she gets completely naked, and he gets completely naked, and they start fucking, and then things start happening. Yeah. And like, because you know something is going to happen, but Lynch is not going to show you it until he is damn well good and ready.
Yeah. And it's like something about, you said earlier about like these actors being like born to read Lynchian dialogue. It's, I think, one of like the greatest marks of like how you can tell of how good a director he is that he can get these exact same performances out of fucking any actor. Like, there's something he can do. It's like the most oddball, weird fucking performances. Where for the longest time, I thought the dude who apparently is from Boardwalk Empire, I thought like, he's like a fucking government employee. He's like, there's something like crazy about this dude, because he seems totally insane. Whereas Californication Lady seems like relatively normal. It's like, oh, this is like a relatively normal performance of a woman that is clearly like romantically interested in this dude and is trying to kind of get something going. And he's just like, every single line, there's like just too long of a pause between every single word.
Hello, Tracy.
Yeah. Hello, Tracy. It's like, oh no, the guard's not here. Oh, that's weird. We should look for him. It goes to the room. Yeah, he isn't here, Tracy. It's just like every single line he says is so insane. And it leads to nothing specific. Like, it's nothing. Like, you never find out. And I don't think we're ever really probably going to go back to those characters and find out that he was some, like, fucking, like, secret agent dude or something crazy.
He's an intern, basically.
Yeah, he's a college student. Like, they are both college students who kind of know each other. And that's it. And it's like all of that acting was more just to, like, build the mood of those scenes. And then, you know, then they just get killed. And it's so amazing to me that he can get those performances from, like, because there's, like, that exact character is in, like, every single Lynch thing. Like,
oh, yeah.
He gets those performances from fucking every single actor he's ever worked with, and it's so amazing.
That character could have been Jack Nance.
Exactly.
In Eraserhead, you know? And that's one of the great tragedies is we won't have Jack Nance in this.
Yeah.
But, you know, and a lot of other good people, of course. But, yeah, no, it's just, Yeah. You know, Matt Zollersites, who's a critic I absolutely love. He writes for Roger Ebert's website and Vulture. And his piece on Twin Peaks this morning I found fascinating, because I think he very much didn't know what to think about it, which is a good place to be.
Yes.
But, you know, one of the things he said was it basically played like a series of Lynch short films under the banner Twin Peaks. And I think it is a little more cohesive than that by design, you know? But, like, it does have that quality where... Yeah. Even if those New York scenes didn't wind up tying into anything, they're just very well-made cinema.
Yeah.
You know? And I say cinema as... Some people have stricter definitions of that. I just kind of mean that as filmmaking in general. Right, and that can be for TV or movies. But, like, yeah, it's like... one of my favorite things to imagine was they did do this L.A. premiere a couple nights ago that somehow they had, you know, a really tight embargo on. But, like, yeah, there was a theater full of people in L.A. who watched those 2 hours.
And only those two hours. And they didn't see episode 3.
That would be... I would give anything to go back in time and be in that audience and watch that unfold.
Because yeah, just, like, of having, like, the credits be playing and then seeing every single person just kind of awkwardly look around and look like they're like, kind of, like, look at someone and, like, they sort of make contact and you see them about to say something and then they, like, think about it and they're like, and, like, don't say anything. And they lean back in their chair, like... And then they look over again, it's like, no. It's like it's the whole theater is people thinking of what they're going to say, about to say it, realize they don't know what they're going to say, sitting back and thinking about what they're going to say, and going through that process for like 30 minutes straight is how I imagine that theater was. Because it's such an insane 2 hours of television.
I mean, I really did come out of those 2 hours. I made a joke tweet about this, like, this could still be an 18-hour prank. Yeah. That, like, he's just going to meander for 18 hours and give Showtime and all of us the bird. That is still totally possible. It'll be a beautifully made middle finger, but it could be that. And
because, I mean, we go through 2 hours of it, and fucking Cooper still is not out of the Red Room.
Yeah.
Like, I kept on thinking, surely that's going to be the end of this thing, is he gets out of the Red Room. That has to be how the premiere ends. There's no way... The premiere ends, and Dale Cooper is still stuck in the Red Room like he was at the fucking beginning of it, like he was at the end of Twin Peaks Season 2, the show that has been on a hiatus or whatever for 25 years, and now has just come back for, like, this weird, like, miniseries thing. You have to end the premiere, at least, with Dale Cooper coming out of the Red Room, and he fucking does it. The premiere ends with what is actually one of my favorite scenes in that whole episode of, like, James in the bar, and Shelley's over there, and they kind of look at each other, and Shelley has that great line of, like, no, that's, James is cool. He's always been cool. And then it goes to credits. Like, that was honestly, like, I think that scene is why I had to watch episode 3 immediately, because that felt like there is... It captured so much about the heart of old Twin Peaks in this one tiny moment that the rest of the premiere wasn't even interested in trying to do. And, like, that one scene, he just, like, grabbed it, and it felt like this is Twin Peaks 25 years later.
Lynch knows what he's doing. He's just not always in a hurry to get there.
Exactly,
you know?
Yeah.
And, yeah, God, if that's the only thing we ever see of James and Shelley in this, and I think we will probably see more...
Yeah.
That would be a beautiful, just little, on its own, little vignette, you know?
Yeah.
Of them in the bar, Shelley with some friends... And both Shelley and James barely look like they've aged, which is an amazing thing. James has a haircut, but I mean, you know, that's just such an interesting little grace note. Yeah, I mean, let's talk about the Twin Peaks scenes.
Okay, yeah.
There's actually not a lot of them.
Yes, and you could tell there's not a lot of them because David Lynch had to be, like, very strict in making sure you saw a sign that said Twin Peaks whenever there was a scene in Twin Peaks, so you're absolutely sure, okay, yes, this is in Twin Peaks. Right. I'm watching the TV show Twin Peaks.
Right. Yeah. Because, you know, we joked about the James storyline from season 2 in that he leaves Twin Peaks. Yeah. And that's notable because Twin Peaks has almost no scenes set outside city limits.
Yeah.
Other than, like, when they go to the border. But still, that's so connected because it's this drug run, you know, between these two towns. So, yeah, no. But the scenes in Twin Peaks start out very odd.
Yeah.
And very kind of... I don't even know what to say. Kind of off. They don't feel quite right, even for Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
But I really did think, further we got into things, I found more of a purpose and a pattern in that, and a beauty in that occasionally.
Yeah.
Because I think that scene with Shelley and James is beautiful. I think the stuff with Bobby in the police station is outstanding.
Oh, God. Yeah.
And I think the further you get into the police station stuff, which is very clearly the heart of Twin Peaks, that space at the moment on this show, I thought it just got kind of better and better. Yeah.
I mean, for me, it was particularly the scene where Hawk and Andy and Lucy are all in the room, like, going through all the evidence, and it's the whole, like, joke with the chocolate bunnies and all that. It's, like, this joke that goes on for, like, over 5 minutes, and it's, like, again, it's one of those scenes where it's like, this scene would not have been done the exact same way in original Twin Peaks or something, but you can see, like, you can feel these characters being the same characters they were from that show and going through, like, similar sort of comic routines, and yet they also have changed. Like, and that's one thing I really love about this show, or, like this revival, is you really do get a good feel for how much these people have changed in the intermittent time. That, like, Andy is very identifiably Andy, but also, like, he's a father now, you know, and he's gained weight, and he's, like, he calls Lucy Pookums and all that stuff. Like, he's not the exact same character we knew, because, of course, he's not. It's 25 years later, and then that age and that time, all the characters wear that.
Yeah, I mean, and of course you gotta talk about one of the most kind of affecting things in the premiere, which is the scenes with the log lady.
Yeah.
And, you know, Catherine Coulson died in 2015, before they shot any of this, and I guess her and Lynch, who are lifelong friends, she worked on Eraserhead. She was married for a time to Jack Nance, who was the star of Eraserhead, so they know each other very well, and I guess he probably just shot these scenes with her on his own, and just they were going to find a place for him. But she's alone. It's kind of a tight shot. She's got an oxygen mask on. She's bald, probably from, it feels like a cancer kind of thing.
Yeah.
And she's got her log, and she's speaking very kind of delicately. Those are hugely moving scenes, because one, I mean, there's just the harsh reality that we know Catherine Coulson died had to be shortly after filming those. And that it, and that Hawk, the way Michael Horst is so good in this.
Yes.
The way he plays those scenes of, like, on one level he's kind of humoring this, you know, old woman he and the town love because she's probably on her deathbed, kind of. And I would be surprised if they don't build in the log lady's death in some way into this. I feel like that's something Lynch wants to do, from what we've seen. But there's just that tenderness to it, but there's also, Hawk is kind of like Cooper and Sheriff Truman. He's okay going on instinct. And he's like, yes, I think she's on to something, so he's going to go along with it. And I love that that's kind of the thing that kicks off this series of events in the town.
Yeah.
Is something that is very much acknowledging the passage of time, you know? That Hawk himself actually has more responsibility than he ever did.
Yeah.
He's the deputy chief now, and stuff like that. So some of those scenes, they lead into other scenes that early on feel awkward, but I just think, you know, they get better and better.
Yeah. And it's also something where the second time she calls and Hawk answers on his cell phone is something where, has now then, like, is kind of like a sort of a running thing, but it's something that I think this revival's relationship with technology, I think, is very interesting. It's something where, like, every single time technology comes up, I feel like it's very specific. And, like, David Lynch focuses on the things that, like, maybe, like, used to be focused on in the mid-90s or something that we don't focus on anymore, particularly the scene where in South Dakota with, like, the TV or the computer and they're processing the fingerprints.
Right.
And it's like, that's such a painstaking scene of, like, you're looking at this fucking computer screen, going through each of the, like, all five of the fingerprints and scanning through all the photos, and something like, it's 2017, you don't do that in police procedurals anymore. Like, in police procedurals, when they do fingerprint stuff, you don't even notice it anymore because it's such a normal, just natural second thought process. That's just something that happens. You never focus on it. But I feel like David Lynch is, like, feels very conscious of, like, all the cameras in the scene with the glass cage and, like, the use of cell phones of, like, you're really expecting that, like, it's, or it's just really surprising when you see Hawk talking on a cell phone to the point where...
Out in the forest.
Yes, out in the forest, and he's like... Because that's such a thing in the old Twin Peaks. If you went out into the forest, you were completely cut off and isolated from everything else because it was the fucking 1990. Nobody had a cell phone. And so, like, the dynamic of how technology has made it that you can't be contained in Twin Peaks. Like, we are interconnected. Like, and that's one of the ways that makes it feel natural that you go to New York City and South Dakota and Las Vegas and all these other locations, because the world is, like, no world can be as small as the town of Twin Peaks anymore. Technology doesn't make that possible.
Yeah, and it's interesting because Lynch is so often blissfully unaware of that stuff.
Yeah.
Because Twin Peaks, Blue Velvet, Mulholland Drive to a degree, most of his films are set either in a 50s pastiche or in kind of a all times exist at once world. You know, where, but Twin Peaks is very much, this Twin Peaks is very much concerned with modernity.
Yes. Which leads me to maybe the best scene ever filmed featuring a computer screen of all time, which is Evil Dale Cooper in the motel with this giant fucking briefcase that he opens up, takes a gigantic modem out, puts it on the table, plugs it with a fucking Ethernet cable into the wall, turns the modem on, turns on the Microsoft Surface, which is a little tiny thin tablet that is embedded in this gigantic fucking briefcase, to go to the FBI website where he's searching for... I don't even remember what the fuck he's even searching for.
The federal prison, right?
Yes, the federal prison. That's right. And he's searching for it, and every single text field he fills in with complete fucking nonsense. And the screen fades in and out for, like, no reasons whatsoever. And, like, the website looks like it was made in the year 2000. And it's like, this is so amazing. This is, like, the most gobbledygook use of technology ever. But it's so, like... But to the extent where it has to be intentional. It's not just that, like, David Lynch is an old man who doesn't get computers. Like, I think he doesn't get computers, but he knows he doesn't get computers. So, like, yeah, like, when he types in, like, enter, like, the name of the person, it's just, like, AB9FG, like, someone just tapping on a keyboard the way that the actors just tap on keyboards in nonsense text scenes. That is basically what is getting entered into every single text field on the website. And it's so amazing because you just see all of it. It's amazing.
But I do think Lynch knows things about technology because, you know, I just think about his relationship with digital cinema because, like, you know, he shot on film for most of his career because that's all there was.
Right.
But as soon as he had a digital camcorder where he could do whatever he wanted with it, he did it. Inland Empire, 3-hour movie, was shot on what at the time was a $4,000 camera.
Huh.
Like, I could buy that camera.
Yeah.
It was a standard... It wasn't even high definition. Standard definition, it looks like so shitty that if the scene is particularly dark or particularly bright, you cannot make out details. It only works in really mid-level crappy lighting.
Great.
But he's like, but I can do so much with this. Think of, like, where I can take the camera and all this stuff. And, you know, New Twin Peaks, obviously, whole thing shot digitally, and I actually think there's something self-conscious about that, particularly in the scene in New York where the kid has all these cameras and it can film an infinite amount. And that he's got this giant, like, you know, case where he takes out the SD cards and puts them in there. And that really does feel like, I think Lynch is fascinated with these technologies. It's become one of his fetishes.
Yeah.
Because he has all these, you know, on-screen fetishes. And that is one of them I feel like we get here, is this, like, this stuff is cool.
Yeah.
You know, even down to, like, it, you know, Cooper is not winning at blackjack in the casino. He's playing all these slot machines.
Yeah.
And it's all this... Well, I love that scene. Anyway, but no, it's like, there is a self-consciousness about it. And I think it's not just Lynch not understanding things. It's, he's fascinated by it. Is the scene with the Microsoft Surface right after he kills Daria?
Yes.
Okay. That, God, that whole sequence of events is insane.
Yeah.
We'll talk about it, though.
Okay, yeah.
Let's keep on some of the Twin Peaks scenes.
All right.
We were talking about. Easy to go off on tangents.
But it comes back to a later Twin Peaks scene also when they introduce Sheriff Truman's brother, Sheriff Truman, who comes in on his cell phone and with one of, like, many unbelievably hilarious scenes in the new Twin Peaks, where you have that great shot where Lucy's so shocked, she just falls out of her chair like it's some fucking, like, 1950s comedy.
He speed ramps it.
Yeah.
He literally speeds up the footage.
It's so amazing. And it's, but it's, again, it's just, like, highlighting these little things you don't think about, but, like, how the times have changed. And that's so much of what Twin Peaks, like, the scene set in Twin Peaks highlights, that is this weird dichotomy between, like, everything, because it's a small town, everything kind of feels the same. All the same people are working at the police station. I suspect when we finally move out of, like, the police station centered stuff and we get, like, the diner, all the same people are going to be working at the diner. Like, everyone is still in their patterns in a lot of ways in the town, who were set in their patterns when we were introduced to it in 1990, but, like, all the kids have grown up and, like, you know, now Bobby's a policeman and stuff like that. Things have changed, but it's like that dynamic is really fascinating.
And clearly we're not anywhere close to, I think, what the main meat of all that will be yet.
Yeah.
But, like, what we've gotten, I do think, is fascinating, because there are, like, you know, it's not just that, you know, 25 years ago on Twin Peaks, there was a plot line where, you know, Andy and Lucy are going to have a baby.
Yeah.
They don't just ignore that. They had a baby, and it's been 25 years, and it grew up to be Michael Cera. And we have to talk about what is one of the most amazing scenes ever filmed.
We can't talk about it right now, though.
Not yet. We'll get there. But, like, those are things that matter, and they've changed these characters, and they are present. And I'm interested with what we've seen so far at the police station, but there's actually only so much you can do at the police station, because those people still have pretty serious, important jobs.
Yeah.
You know, Hawk has only changed so much, for instance, because... He's Hawk. He was pretty good at what he did. He's still pretty good at what he does. And so you have all of that. But then when you start getting those hints, like the Shelley James scene, that's a really interesting sequence because of what it suggests.
Yeah.
I also think when Bobby showed up, And I'm not even a huge fan of Bobby. I wanted to cheer because I thought that was such a thoughtful reinvention of that character. Like,
yeah,
I think Bobby could become a police officer because, like, everything that happened to him would be so scarring. Maybe he just wants to get on the right path.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what we get. And there is that amazing scene that shouldn't work as well as it does, where all the evidence is laid out, and Bobby comes... They're showing it to Sheriff Truman.
Yeah.
New Sheriff Truman. And Bobby comes into the room and sees the picture of Laura Palmer, and we get the Laura Palmer theme for the first time. They're actually very judicious with the music they use here. They're not just throwing out the Badalamenti themes right and left. And he just starts crying. And it's a specific callback, I think, to episode 14 of the original show, which is where Maddie dies, and Bobby has like this instinctual, empathetic thing where he starts crying at the roadhouse.
Yeah.
And you get that here, too. And he starts crying, and it's like, yeah, it's been 25 years, but this was a... This is something that would have shaped Bobby's life.
Yeah.
And, like, it would be so hard to be reminded of that. And it's heightened in the way Twin Peaks is heightened with these things, but it's a weirdly beautiful scene.
Yeah, and I think it also, like, just invites, if you're, like us, the huge fan of Fire Walk With Me, like, that movie changed so much of that relationship that it immediately made me think of, like, right, like, because it's not just the death of Laura Palmer. It's, like, the life of Laura Palmer and how much Bobby's life was, like, changed by that. I mean, you know... He did cocaine. He fucking killed a guy in Fire Walk With Me. Like, that, all that stuff happened. And, like, there's that, like, having that scene, I feel like it's like, if you're a fan of Twin Peaks, like, should bring to your mind all of that stuff and, like, that, how complex that relationship was.
Yeah, I mean, none of these character appearances so far are random fan service.
Yeah.
And I've seen some people say, like, oh, those are the scenes that feel like Lynch's heart isn't in it. I see where some of that sentiment comes from. I just disagree with it.
Yeah, me too.
You know, because I can see early on sometimes it does feel that way. But I do think, and part of that is because those are the most direct comparisons we have in filmmaking styles. And he is directing this very different than he directed old Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
And I think that's just some of it. And once you settle into the rhythms, it's all good. But yeah, I mean, I think they're very interesting. And I, you know, we've seen so few of these characters. We didn't even talk about the Ben and Jerry Horn scene.
Oh, yeah.
That is... It has nothing to do with anything else in the episode. Maybe it will more because Ashley Judd is playing his secretary.
Yeah.
And that feels like a significant piece of casting. But, like, that is a hilarious scene. And also, like, yeah, Ben Horn would still be doing his thing.
Yeah.
And Jerry would absolutely be selling legalized marijuana in the state of Seattle. Of course he would.
It's so good. He comes in with that beard and everything. It's so good. And just, like, seeing how they're... It's another one of those things of, like, how their relationship is so similar. And yet, at the same time, you can kind of feel that Ben has maybe started to move on. And actually, like, you know, it's taken him a while. But Ben has started to kind of mature on these things a little bit, even if he's not all the way there.
Right. I mean, you know, he is not munching into the pot cake or whatever he had the way he did the brie sandwich back in the day.
Yeah.
No, God, Jerry's dialogue in that scene is poetry.
Mm-hmm.
It is like psychedelic LSD, get on the magic school bus kids poetry.
Yeah. And it's like when you find out that he's eating pot brownies, it's like, okay, yes, now all of his dialogue makes perfect sense to me.
Yes. Lynch and Frost probably were too when they wrote this. Anyway.
Lynch does not need anything to go to these places. He does not need any external.
No.
That's all in his heart.
Can we talk about Michael Cera?
Okay, yeah. Well, let's talk about the Michael Cera scene.
Okay. I'll back up.
Okay.
The one thing we haven't talked about is new Sheriff Truman.
Right, yeah.
You get an intimation early on when Lucy is like, which Sheriff Truman? Which is a hilarious scene and such a Lucy moment.
Yeah.
But later on, you get Robert Forster. And here's the thing. I did know going into this that Michael Aunt Keen is not in this.
Yeah, me too.
Because he's retired. I don't know if he's sick. I haven't heard anything about that. But he is retired and I guess he doesn't want to act anymore. Which is his right as an American.
Yeah.
So, but he didn't want to be in it. They hired Robert Forster. He's been credited in the show notes as Sheriff Truman. So I thought maybe they just recast him. And... You know, Robert Forster would be a great recast for Sheriff Truman because he'd be great for fucking anything. He's Robert Forster. But, like, so when it started, I'm like, maybe that's the same character. I don't know. And then it's like, no, of course, this is a Lynch thing. It's his brother who came to town probably because other Sheriff Truman is sick or something.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's probably the most soap opera, like, element of Twin Peaks-esque thing that the new revival has done so far is that... Sheriff Truman has his brother, Sheriff Truman, that covers for Sheriff Truman when Sheriff Truman is sick. So you need healthy Sheriff Truman to come in.
But that's what this show does.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. I love it. And we get like 18 hours of Robert Forster.
Yes.
It's an amazing thing. I want this man.
Yeah. But you've not just 18 hours of Robert Forster, but we get at least so far like about 10 minutes of Robert Forster acting opposite Michael Cera.
Yep, we do. And we're going to get him acting opposite Kyle MacLachlan, hopefully.
Yes.
At some point.
Probably two Kyle MacLachlans. At least two.
Yeah.
I'm still holding out hope that Dougie comes back somehow.
All will be... Maybe it'll have a... Lynch projects often have happier endings than you remember. Maybe there'll be a happy ending where he reunites Dougie with Naomi Watts.
I mean, maybe this is all just a fever dream that Dougie has because he has a stroke after he's with the prostitute lady. That was the only scene that happened in reality was Dougie,
post-coitus. All of Twin Peaks. Old, yeah. New, it's all Dougie's hallucinations.
Yes, about when he used to be a secret FBI agent.
No, but you're right. Okay. Truman, Rich... Yeah, he gets... fucking 10 minutes opposite Michael Cera, and it is some of the greatest 10 minutes of TV history.
It's
so funny.
It's unbelievable.
I mean, just the fact he drives up, and Michael Cera is Andy and Lucy's kid, because of course he is, and that's amazing. But he was born on Marlon Brando's birthday, his middle name is Marlon, he's dressing like a really bad Marlon Brando cosplay, yeah. And he has this whole speech about, my dharma is the road. What is your
dharma is, and then he just gestures to the town. But you forgot the best part of his costume. It's not that it's like he's dressing up like a Marlon Brando costume reject. It's that he's dressing up as a Marlon Brando costume reject, and he has his name Wally sewed into the jacket in like bright white thread in this like really stylized 50s font. And so he's just like, and it's like right in the basically the middle of the frame, so you're just staring at the name Wally constantly while he's talking,
because it's one setup too. It's one shot on Wally.
It feels like it was like one take, I think, of just like Michael Cera just like learned all those lines. Maybe he improvised some of it, I have no idea. This just, but it feels like, you know, Michael Cera is an actor who has been in some interesting stuff, mostly comedic roles, but it feels like he was born to play Wally on Twin Peaks somehow.
He so was. That scene is so funny. He has the whole thing about, you know, my dharma is the road. He says, I've traveled from Alexandria, Virginia, here to Spokane, Washington, following the path of Lewis and his compatriot, Clark.
The first two Caucasians to see this part of our great country.
It's so funny. It's like someone read Jack Kerouac and got high and wrote like 10 minutes of dialogue. It's so funny.
It's just, it just goes, it goes, it goes. And the whole time I was just imagining like what this kid's life was like being raised by Andy and Lucy. And yes, he would turn out like this somehow. Like somehow this is the product of that unholy union.
But this is like, this is what I love about David Lynch. He's in his like 70s.
Yeah.
He's built such a career. He would never have to direct another thing to prove himself. He gets this opportunity and he is so playful with it.
Yeah.
These four episodes, and you don't realize it in just the premiere.
Yes.
But if you watch the premiere in 3 and 4, you realize this is such a playful version of Twin Peaks. And he is absolutely willing to take the time to invite Michael Cera out to set to have him play Wally Marlon, or whatever his name is, Wally Brando. I forget what the middle name he gets.
I think it's Marlon.
Yeah. And just to goof like this and then keep it in the show because he can.
Yeah.
You know, that is... it's amazing that he wanted to do this and just be this playful with it. I love that.
And like, and just because the best part of about the comedic setup is that it is just this like shot reverse shot of like, and it's like the same shots, and it's like this 5 to 10 minute scene, and the reverse shot is just Robert Forster desperately trying to find a way to end this conversation. And he can't.
Like,
may the road rise up to meet your wheels. That's a beautiful turn of phrase, Sheriff Truman.
And this is one scene. There are so many comedic masterpieces in this episode, in these four episodes. And they just kind of get funnier as they go along, too, as you kind of get into the groove of things.
Yeah.
But it's like, yeah, I have always found Lynch funny. I've said that. That's like the thing that first maybe attracted me to David Lynch is the humor, because I think he's very funny as a director. But the 4 hours I watched last night, I might have laughed more and harder at than any other Lynch thing.
Yeah, I think this is the funniest he's ever been. Because it's also like the other side of like the more familiar Twin Peaks stuff is, if you don't get any of this in the premiere, I don't think, but in episode 3 is when you cut to the FBI.
Yep, we have to talk about this.
Where you have Gordon Cole, played by David Lynch, obviously. And then you have Albert with Miguel Ferrer, who unfortunately has passed away since his performance. But you get them there, and that's where you get the follow-up on the New York scene. But before that, you have this unbelievable scene that feels like it's like from the beginning of Fire Walk With Me or whatever, where they're going through these like it's like this these six pieces of evidence on the table that's like all these random items, and they're talking about some insane case. You have no idea what they're talking about. And then at the end, it's just Gordon Cole going, "It's the congressman's dilemma." It's just like, then they just move on.
Gordon Cole is so good in this. Like, I thought Gordon Cole was a funny character in the original series. Small Mexican chihuahua.
Yeah.
It's phenomenal. But David Lynch was a better actor here than he's ever been. He gave Gordon Cole all these kind of modulations to play. Like, there's that phenomenal scene at the end of episode 4 where he turns it up way loud so he and Albert can just have this little heart-to-heart. Actually, just a beautiful little scene.
Yeah.
But then he just, Gordon Cole is so funny. Because in that same scene you're talking about, what made me laugh so hard, I freaked out my brother in another room. I laughed so hard at this. Is they see the image of the two dead kids from New York. And he goes, "What the hell is that?" And it's such a great line reading because it comes out of nowhere. And what's funniest about Gordon Cole is everyone in the room knows him so well, they don't react to him being a weirdo.
Yeah, but like, I just love David Lynch's commitment to. In Twin Peaks, it was like when he originally directed Twin Peaks, it was in Fire Walk With Me, it's in it now, of just like the FBI is up to the most insane shit when you're not seeing them, and every time you just cut to them, they're talking about like the most absurd cases, you know, like it's like in Fire Walk With Me where they randomly cut to like you're introduced to the one detective dude, and there's just like a fucking school bus full of prostitutes, you're like, what the hell? What the hell was that? What was that movie?
It really does feel like all the FBI scenes were cutting into a different series that's like a Zucker Brothers comedy of the FBI, but we're just getting little glimpses of it.
It's so good. But yeah, then you get like all of that stuff with the FBI. I love of that. Like you said, it's not just that it's unbelievably funny, and I think it's funnier than it's ever been with Gordon Cole, but they also find like a really good heart in a lot of those scenes with like Albert and in Gordon Cole and them finding out, you know, that Cooper's alive somewhere.
Gordon Cole has almost never been used for like the dramatic side of Twin Peaks before. And frankly, he's the protagonist of episode 4 here. And like, you know, you get that scene where they go meet evil Cooper in the prison. There's really not a lot of laughs there, but it's fascinating to watch. And Cole just kind of deflates seeing this. It's a really interesting note for that character. That the sojourn to South Dakota, though, also gets my favorite line from these 4 hours. Can I do it?
Yeah.
All right. Ahead. They're in the car driving, and then the new agent they're working with, like the young hot agent, is like leaning out the window, and Gordon leans over to Albert and says, "Albert, what's up with her?" And Albert says, "Oh, she gets car sick." He says, "Albert, we're in South Dakota. Cossacks are from Russia."
And that's just when Albert just snaps for a second, and you see old asshole Albert come through. He's like, "Carsick!" And then the car, like, shoves over to the side.
Yeah.
Oh, it's such a good scene. Yeah, that Cossacks line.
Cossacks are from Russia. It's so great.
We're in South Dakota. Yeah, man.
Oh,
Gordon Cole and Albert.
God.
I'm so excited to see more of them. Like, because it is that scene where he turns up the hearing aid all the way. And just, like, you know, he and Albert get to, like, you know, like you said, have that, like, kind of man-to-man talk about what happened with Coop, and then Albert talks about, you know, there's all this like weird world building stuff about Philip Jeffries, the David Bowie character from who's in one scene in Fire Walk With Me, which, and this is saying something, the most inexplicable scene in Fire Walk With Me probably, and they feel very committed to keeping that character somehow in the Twin Peaks universe.
Well, and David Bowie was going to be in this.
Yeah, I heard that.
Passed away, so.
Yeah, so but, like that whole scene, it's just. It's something that you just never saw on old Twin Peaks. Like, you did see more of that side of Albert as the series went on, but even then, like, he was mostly used as a straight comedic character. And here, like, both of them get to take on a much more dramatic role, and that's really interesting. It's a character territory they've not really ever broached before.
It really is funny. I think if you had told me we were going to get 4 hours of new Twin Peaks and Kyle MacLachlan would really never play Dale Cooper in those four hours, I would have been worried about that because that's like, if I had one expectation, it was Cooper. And we didn't get that, and I'm so okay with it. One, because McLaughlin gets to do so many other amazing things.
Yeah.
But also because where they choose to pick up the slack is so interesting, and I don't feel like I'm missing things at any point.
Yeah, like both the returning stuff, like the FBI feels like, the FBI sequences in episode 4 feel like the most significant like element of a returning Twin Peaks character that's not Cooper or Bob. But so, and that stuff's really good. But then also they fill it in with so much new stuff, like the murder case in South Dakota and like the New York City stuff, that you never feel like you said, you're never missing out on something because you're getting something new while the old is kind of very slowly creeping up until eventually there's going to be some kind of resolution to that or something.
Yeah. Who knows? So two more things before I want to go to South Dakota, because we talked about New York, Twin Peaks, all the FBI, all this stuff. Miguel Ferrer is so good.
Yes.
And, you know, so melancholy kind of seeing him, you know, rise from the dead to play this kind of, from our point of view, but also so like, thank God he got to do it.
Yes.
You know, because he's fantastic. And that's great. Also the David Duchovny scene.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
That was very good. I did not know David Duchovny was coming back for this, so that was a fun surprise.
I had kind of heard about it in the same way with like the Michael Cera stuff, as I had heard about that like 3 months ago. I saw it on like Wikipedia or some shit, and then completely forgot. And so when she comes in,
it's a good scene. Yeah. You know, like again, Denise is probably not how you would portray a transgender character if you created the show in 2017.
No,
but what I do love about Denise then and now is that Denise has just chosen what she wants to be, even though that includes, you know, still having a very masculine voice and things like that. And she is so confident in that and so good at her job and everything. And Gordon Cole and Dale Cooper are so accepting of those things that it's just like, yeah, that's who she is. And there's something kind of weirdly beautiful about that.
Yeah, and it's something that, like, her appearance in new Twin Peaks, like, it fixed the one thing that I think old Twin Peaks could be rocky on with her more than anything else was... Like, they used her for comedic effect sometimes in old Twin Peaks in a way that, like, it felt, like, too close of striding a line between, like, is she in on the joke or, like, the butt of the joke? And, like, that's a hard thing to do, especially in the 90s. But here it feels like they're not playing it up for humor in any way. And that's, like, the right way to do it.
There are laughs in that scene, but it's, like, two friends talking kind of laughs.
Yeah.
It's a great scene. And I like Gordon Cole, like, you know, his whole speech about, like, you know, how he kind of helped her kind of come out and all that stuff.
Yeah. He says some great line about, like, they need to fix their soul or die.
Yep.
This is really good. Or he's just like, well, there's more than room for one beautiful woman in the FBI.
Yep, that's great. Yeah, all right, so we got all that. South Dakota.
Yes.
This was probably one of the more perplexing things in the premiere to me, because it takes the longest to kind of tie into things in some ways. Or, like, at least the New York thing has sort of a forward momentum to it that you kind of get right away. The South Dakota thing is, like, kind of like the beginning of Fire Walk With Me, this dark mirror of, like, the original Twin Peaks case, although here much more grisly.
Yeah.
And it opens with a pretty funny scene of this woman with her dog having this smell in the room, and it is maybe the most taxing in terms of duration of these 4 episodes, but I also found it very funny.
I've loved it, especially like once the cops come in and the cops trying to figure out how to get this fucking key is really funny.
Yeah, but then they get in there and it's not just a woman dead on the bed, but her decapitated head on a different body.
Yeah.
So you've got some kind of serial killer shit going on.
Yes.
I don't know who the name of the actor who plays the main detective here, but he's like a character actor you see in everything, and I love seeing him here. He's really good in this.
He's really good.
But then you get to, okay, they've identified this guy, this principal, and he's played by Matthew Lillard, Shaggy from the Scooby-Doo movies, if you didn't know that. Who's also?
I'm sure that's what he wants to be remembered for.
He came back to voice Shaggy in one of the animated Scooby-Doo spinoffs.
Of course, like if someone asks you to voice Shaggy in Scooby-Doo, you're not going to say no.
Yeah, no, but like Matthew Lillard did have this kind of stoner comedy thing earlier in life, but he's been in a couple dramatic roles lately. He's been very good in it. He's fantastic in this.
Yeah,
like just this guy shaking apart at the seams. You know, there's a lot of ways you can read those scenes that maybe he was inhabited by Bob, he was manipulated by, you know, evil Cooper, whatever it is. But I like that we don't have any specifics on that yet. He could just be crazy.
Yeah.
We don't know. He's really good.
Yes, and you get that great scene where he's in the, like, there's just a whole series of great scenes. So the interrogation scene is great. Then when they bring his wife to the jail, that scene is great. You find out, like, you know, like, that is, like, one of the most dysfunctional marriages I've seen in TV. Like, it's, like, their conversation is really interesting. But then you get that just incredible shot of him in the cell on his own, and then it starts slowly panning to the right, and you see a couple of empty cells, and then it's just a cell with, like, a ghostly apparition that kind of looks like whatever the fuck the thing was in the box in the premiere episode, and then it just slowly fades away, and that's it. And it just cuts to another scene. It's like, okay, yeah, I don't know what the fuck that is.
One of two big scares in the premiere.
Yeah.
I found that one even scarier than the box.
It's just, like, very unsettling.
It's so unsettling. It's... God, you know what it's like? It's like the bear giving the dog a blowjob in Shining.
Okay, yeah.
When the guy in the suit,
sure, yes,
or whatever it is, like,
yeah.
Or
he's, yeah, the people in the costumes,
yeah, giving, yes. Yeah, because it just
forming
comes out of
sex,
yeah, so it just comes out of absolutely nowhere. And here's the other thing that freaked me out about it is I chose that moment. I got like a text on my phone or something, and it was one of the only times I checked my phone during these 4 hours. As I brought it up and as I put it back down, it was panning and the thing appeared.
Great,
I was like,
yeah.
Oh, what the fuck did I miss?
Yeah,
like, yeah.
But it's just one of those. The elements of sort of the magical realism kind of stuff of that so far this new series of Twin Peaks has been more like has been pretty light on that, and that felt like that was just like, okay, yeah, like that's like I don't even necessarily ever need that to be clarified in any way because it just
right.
felt so like weirdly evocative, and I feel like it
well,
set such a mood.
Let's
you know?
Talk about the magical realism, metaphysics, surrealism,
yeah.
whatever we want to call it. Because in some ways, this is much heavier on the metaphysics, certainly.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, this is something we talked about that we didn't like about the back half of season two of Twin Peaks, is
mm-hmm.
how much it starts literalizing things like Bob and the Red Room. In some ways, Lynch has doubled down on that narratively here.
Yeah.
Because the Red Room is a clear other dimension. Cooper can travel back and forth from it. Bodies are being inhabited. There is an evil Dale Cooper out in the world. There are multiple people played by Kyle MacLachlan in
yes.
this. He appears through a fucking electrical outlet. Like, this goes so much further with that stuff than the show ever has. And yet, at the same time, it feels so much like it's been returned to the kind of eerie otherworldliness that we got early in Twin Peaks that kind of got sanded down
yeah.
over time. And I think some of that is just Lynch has a touch with this directorially that other people can't have. But I don't know. It's such a weird balancing act they're playing.
I think, like, one of the main tricks, and it's, like, kind of what I was referring to when we were talking about, like, starting episode three and the beginning of episode three, like, feeling like, okay, like, this, it makes sense now, is that, like, I was kind of saying it as a joke, but it's true, like, the Red Room is the, like, foundation. That's the base. Like, that, we know the Red Room exists. Like, Bob is a, whatever Bob is, and is occupying Dale Cooper's body, and there's an evil Dale Cooper. Like, that, none of that stuff is played up to be ambiguous at all. Like, they straight up show clips from the finale of season two of Twin Peaks to, like, directly say, like, yes, Bob is in your body, and he is out there, he is your doppelganger, like, all of that stuff. But then, like, now, we just take that is reality, and we understand that is reality, and I feel like there's now another layer, like, there's a level above that, which is all the stuff of, in, like, the weird boiler room in space, and the box, and whatever's appearing in the box, and the apparition in the cell, and the weird murder stuff of, like, the body with the head. It's, like, all of that stuff is now completely inexplicable, and we have no idea, like, can that be explained through Red Room bullshit? Like, I don't know.
Yeah, and I have a very similar feeling, because through the first 2 hours, the premiere, whenever we cut to the Red Room, there was some interesting stuff in there, and certainly they went out on a couple of limbs, hence the evolution of the
yes.
arm. But, like, I also felt it was a little tired. Like,
yeah.
we've seen enough of the Red Room. Do we really need 18 more hours of this? And Lynch's answer is, no, I'm just getting started.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, episode 3 of this Twin Peaks very much feels like the third episode of original Twin Peaks, and
yeah.
that's the turning point, and part of that is I had the exact same kind of feeling watching the beginning of episode 3 here as I did watching the end of the third episode of original Twin Peaks, which is where you first see the Red Room,
yeah.
of like, okay, this is new, this is unlike anything I've ever seen, this is full of mystery and the darkest wonder, it is truly sublime in the true sense of that word, of like what Edmund Burke would say about
yeah.
sublimity, in that it's the kind of beauty that scares you with an existential kind of terror. The Red Room cannot give us that anymore. But whatever that boiler in space was, that sure as shit gave it to me.
Yeah, exactly. It's and I think another element that they did of going in the direction of having like two Dale Coopers, of having it be a full doppelganger thing, I think that also helps capture that in a way that the sort of more predictable follow-on from season two of Twin Peaks, which is one of the reasons why I never liked like that, the idea of that ending was the idea of, I think what they were going to do in actual season three of Twin Peaks if it had been made, is that, you know, Kyle MacLachlan has to play Bob in Dale Cooper's body, who's going around and having to kind of trick everybody else and do like secretly murder someone or something, and like doing that, and that just feels like kind of tired. Like, that just, there's something about that plot line that just does not attract me at all. Whereas the idea of having both of them coexist, and that, like, it's very attractive to me. I always like doppelganger stuff in fiction. I think it's like a very potent material to deal with like weird themes, and having, you know, it helps a lot when you have an actor as talented as Kyle MacLachlan doing this stuff and going around as evil Dale and stumbling around as good Dale, and like having it sets up such a fascinating dynamic, and I'm so excited to see where that goes and how that develops, because I think they have found the best way, I think, to continue to take the ending of season two of Twin Peaks at, like, as literal as it should be interpreted, and then just like continue on with it instead of doing what we suspected like one possible path would have been, which is just to completely ignore it entirely.
Yeah, or be like, you know, Dale says to Sheriff Truman, "Man, remember when I was evil for a week?
Yeah,
that was crazy.
I sure am glad we managed to find the Rainbow Lodge that held access to the Ocarina of Death that allowed me to exorcise the evil spirit of Bob. That was sure a wacky adventure in the Death Dimension."
Okay, I would like to go to the alternate reality where we got that scene, though, and watch it. No. Yes. But, like, yeah, it is interesting that as different as this is from original Twin Peaks, and as unexpected as so much of this is, one of the craziest things to me is how direct a continuation it is of at least that one specific plot line.
Yes.
So let's talk about Kyle MacLachlan.
Yes, because we've talked around him for a lot. Let's dig into...
Jesus, he's good in this.
He is so good.
He is playing so many different characters, because let's just count him. Evil Dale Cooper.
Yes.
You have Cooper in the Lodge, who is Dale Cooper, but he's like silent and kind of affected by this, right?
He's like Dream Cooper.
Yeah, Dream Cooper. You have Dougie Jones.
Yeah. Inimitable Dougie Jones.
Who's a great little character creation for however many minutes he's on screen. And then you have, you know, Veggie Cooper, or whatever you want to call him, where he is just stumbling around and kind of an empty husk, and who knows that how long that will last for.
But and so then far, you have actual Dale Cooper in the clips from old Twin Peaks to remind you that of like the man he once was.
And it really does feel like building the story around Cooper getting back both to Twin Peaks and to himself, kind of, is really a motivation, I feel like, to pull you through all of this, because we want him to get there. Yeah. But while he's on the way there, it's goddamn entertaining.
It's so amazing.
He, like, as other than as Evil Cooper, he almost has no dialogue in these 4 hours. Yeah. And yet he does so much acting.
Mm-hmm.
He does so much beautiful, wonderful, silent acting. Especially when he, you know, those episodes 3 and 4. Oh my God. Like, David Lynch could not find a more willing participant than Kyle MacLachlan for some of the shit he asks that guy to do, like, you know, be probably suspended by wires on a green screen to fly through New York City and shit like that. It's just, he is so game for everything, and he really ties this whole thing together.
You know that David Lynch must have been so exact about the exact speed that Dale Cooper was supposed to shuffle at all times. That's like, it has to be this slow. You know, like, I know it's utterly unnatural. It makes no sense. Nobody would ever, like, working at a casino, see a guy shuffle in to a casino like this at this, like, insanely slow speed and just let that happen. But you just go with it. Like, yes, 0.01 miles per hour, that is the appropriate speed to move at.
It absolutely is. And yeah, Kyle MacLachlan is just game for all of it. You know, he was so much like David Lynch's muse for a couple of years there with Dune and Twin Peaks and Blue Velvet. And then they didn't work together again for a very long time. And that's kind of sad. I always thought there's like a hole in David Lynch's filmography of more he could have done with him. And now we have it.
We have so much more of it.
And, you know, really that is going to be a significant working relationship between these two.
Yeah.
And it really does, you can just feel how in sync they are, because that scene that opens episode 3, and I say scene, it's like 20 minutes long. Yeah. But like all of that, it is so beautifully crafted and mounted. It is one of the most sublime, crazy things I have ever seen in filmmaking, period. But really, Kyle MacLachlan does so much to tie that together and have that sense of kind of dreamy wonder at everything. And, you know, that scene couldn't work if you didn't have that actor at the heart of it.
Yeah.
Acting opposite a woman with no eyes and things like that.
I mean, it is. I've always been astounded at his ability to act in, like, the Red Room scenes and then now this of, like, it's such a bizarre thing to ask an actor to do that is, like, you're not... I can't imagine you take an acting class that tells you how to, like, stumble around in an abstract dream state and as, like, this, like, weird, passive, dream-like observer. But he, like, all the way back in, like, original Twin Peaks, and now he still fucking has it. Like, he just is able to anchor you in those scenes in a way you're able to buy those scenes. Whereas, like, in others, like, kind of more avant-garde filmmaking, a lot of times I find, like, when I sort of step a little bit more over on that side of the line where I don't usually go, it's like, you don't have any anchor. It just feels like, I don't know, this just isn't interesting. Whereas he just, like, sits you in that scene and, like, I can focus on the scene because he's there.
And, you know, Laura Dern is very good at that in her collaborations with Lynch. Like, Inland Empire is all Laura Dern. She's, like, in every scene. She's great at that. Naomi Watts is really good at that in Mulholland Drive. Yeah. And I was so happy to see her here. Because that's another thing. Like, she's has a little voice clip in Inland Empire. But otherwise, they only did Mulholland Drive together. It basically launched Naomi Watts's, you know, to stardom.
Yeah.
And she's so good in that. I'm so glad she gets to do more with Lynch. Who knows how big this role will be. But, like, you can feel, like, she's on that wavelength.
Yeah.
And, you know, I do think, as weird as what Lynch demands from actors, he does have a kind of surprisingly large pool to draw from of people who just get it.
Yeah.
And Kyle MacLachlan is definitely at or near the top of that list.
Yes.
So, Evil Cooper.
Yes. Let's talk about, like, what is... like, another one of my favorite scenes from the premiere that was, like, one of the scenes once, like, you saw it, I was like, okay, yes, I'm really starting to buy this, which is the introduction scene for Evil Cooper, which is this just one of the most Twin Peaks shots ever, which is the first-person view from, like, the hood of the car going through this, like, dark road at night with the trees, and it's just, like, this long shot with just the headlights illuminating these trees in this road while this just, like, insane version of, I think it was American Woman or something. I couldn't figure out what the song was because it was so bizarre, and then at the end of the credits you see it's, like, American Woman, parentheses, David Lynch version or whatever it says. It's like, okay, that's what that song was. It sounded vaguely familiar. It's like the version of American Woman you would hear if you were being eaten by Satan in the pits of hell and you kind of make it out from the mortal realm. Like, that's what it sounded like. And it's just like this screeching version of that song, and then you have fucking, and you have no idea who it is because you haven't seen in the car, and you're just like watching this dark road illuminated by these headlights and listening to this hell music, and then this man in a leather jacket with great hair steps out of this car. And the camera slowly kind of spins around a little bit, and you kind of just notice it, and you're like, oh my fucking God, that's Kyle MacLachlan. That's fucking Evil Dale Cooper Bob. Like, that's what they're doing. And holy shit, does Kyle MacLachlan knock that out of the park. He is so intimidating. He's so, like, It's fucking like Kyle MacLachlan playing Anton Chigurh from No Country for Old Men. And it's unbelievable.
He does.
It's so good.
It is so good. And what's so great about it to me, partially, is it's both incredibly silly. Yeah. Like, they put him in a wig and, like, this face paint and the fucking leather jacket and everything. He is kind of the parody version of what this should be. But at the same time, Kyle MacLachlan is so good and the direction is so tight. He's genuinely scary.
Yeah. I mean, you just have that scene, like, right before he goes to the motel to kill the woman, where he's with the guy outside the car, and he just starts, like, rubbing the dude's face, and he just rubs the dude's face for, like, 2 minutes, and then it cuts away, and you know that guy's dead. And that's, like, actually, like, a pivotal element of the motel scene, is that, yeah, he just got finished killing that dude, so this woman is talking bullshit to him.
Yeah.
Like, that's, it's just so good. He has such a menace to him, but at the same time, like you said, it should be silly. It should be so much sillier than it actually comes across.
And at some points they do undercut it. Like when he, you know, has the car crash and everything. He's driving like a badass down the road and he's not prepared for what's happening. And, you know, there is some very direct plot going on here where, again, he knows, I've had my 25 years. I'm supposed to go to the Black Lodge. I love all of that, that it's kind of that direct. But he's like, I'm not going to because I'm a rebel. That scene with Daria is very interesting.
Yeah.
he was definitely channeling some Frank Booth there, Dennis Hopper, and he's absolutely terrifying. It is a long, scary scene, especially because they keep checking in with Daria saying, like, you're going to kill me, right? And he says, yes, but it just keeps going.
Yeah.
I think there's a conversation to be had that so far we don't have a lot of prominent female characters in this Twin Peaks.
Sure.
And that is a pretty sadistic scene. And I do hope that evens out, because I think David Lynch does feature violence against women in a lot of his films. I think he does it with a critical and responsible eye. I just hope it's evened out in some way, because usually when he does that, it's also balanced out with some more female representation.
Yeah.
But we're also we're two-ninths of the way into this thing, so who knows?
Yeah, because it is like another element of this series that really surprised me, and it's really heavily featured in that scene, and then the body in South Dakota is how violent this is. Like the scene where he kills her, where he like basically punches her in the face, puts a pillow over her head, puts a gun, the way I thought, like, oh, he knocked her out and he's just going to smother her. But no, he grabs a gun and fucking shoots her in the head under the pillow, and then takes the pillow off, and it's like the smoke coming out. It's like, and you hear the sizzle. It's like, Jesus Christ. Like, that's, you know, I've watched a lot of movies where people get shot in the head, and usually, like, you know, that's like 95% of what John Wick is as a franchise. It's just people getting shot in the head. And you usually don't think about it, but that, like, it's always like whenever a movie is able to have feature violence and then like focus on one small detail about the violence that you usually don't think about, and that, like, it's the heat from the discharge of the gun, especially contained underneath the pillow, that's like, that's such a brutal detail to focus on that, like, really made the violence feel affecting.
It is. And I mean, you know, David Lynch at his best does have, I think, this blend where he can go that dark and that gruesome, but also have, like, the scene in the casino.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think Blue Velvet hits that mix a lot, and Twin Peaks at its best hits that mix a lot. Mulholland Drive certainly does. And this is that, too. Like, this is not watered down David Lynch.
No.
This is, you haven't seen me, I haven't done nothing yet, David Lynch, you know? It's kind of crazy.
It's very crazy.
All right. God, what else is there to talk about? I mean, we could go on and on and on, but...
I mean, and one other element of, like, the Kyle MacLachlan stuff I want to focus in on is, like, the end of episode 4 and all of the stuff in the house. And I think there's a very clear thing I think that David Lynch is doing. Of like, you know, the stuff that he sometimes does with the meta-narrative stuff, where it feels like, particularly, I think, this feels like the stuff I've seen that he's made of the 21st century... It feels like he's very aware of how people watch his stuff and put stuff in there to comment on it, like the scene at the end of Mulholland Drive of the key, the blue key in the trash, literally in the garbage. The thing that, like, everyone likes to focus on is, like, the big symbolic, the key to the movie. This, like, oh, this is the key used to unlock all the symbolic meaning. Is like, no, it's garbage. It's trash. It's literally in the trash. It's in the world of the trash man. The key is nothing. Like, don't...
It's also literally a different prop in the second half of the movie than it is in the first.
It's really good. It's like, it just feels like a very direct nod to be like, no, like, this is trash. This Twin Peaks, and there's two things I feel like are very clearly kind of that. One, I already kind of mentioned it, is the frequent, like, presence and repetition of specific numbers that happens. I mean, it's like in the very first scene, the giant tells him, I don't even remember what the judge is, just like, remember, like, 48 and 31 or whatever it is. That never come up again, and there's just, like, the numbers in the boiler scene on the outlet that changes from 15 to 3, and then there's, like, the weird, like, drug-addicted woman in this, like, in the house across the street from where Dougie was with the prostitute, who's just screaming out, like, 1,098 or whatever number she screams. She just screams it, like, 5 times, and there's just all these utterly meaningless numbers that people are, like, screaming out in a way that feels like David Lynch... like marathoned Lost like 2 years ago and then read like some, like, a couple of internet reactions or something to it. It's like, I'm gonna do this and just make it so bullshit, so nothing. It's gonna drive some people so crazy trying to figure out what all these numbers mean. It's like, it's so clearly meaningless. It's so obviously nothing, but you know people are gonna fucking turn themselves into pretzels trying to bidding around figuring out what all these numbers mean.
Yeah, David Lynch is many things. He's not oblivious.
Yeah.
He likes to keep a distance from the world, but he is not unaware that he is putting this show out in a very literal-minded atmosphere of criticism. Yeah. And you're right, I do think the numbers... At first I was like, because there are some moments like that on Twin Peaks that do lead places.
Yeah.
But once we got a couple of them, right, I just started laughing. Because it's like, yeah, that's just him trolling people.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful.
Yeah. And the other ones, one of those I felt, and it's something I think you kind of referenced earlier, is in episode 4 in particular... You keep on waiting for Dale Cooper to have this moment where he wakes up and becomes Dale Cooper again. And there's so many. And it's like, it even starts at episode 3 with, like, when the prostitute says, you know, go on, get out of here. And he has, like, that flashback to Laura Palmer saying that in the Red Room, like, you can go on, you can leave or whatever. It is like, oh, he's going to put it together and he's kind of, like, going to come back. And then it's nothing. He's, like, the exact same. And then later he gets dropped off and he sees the owl in the sky. You're like, he sees the owl and he's going to be like, oh, like, never trust the owls, or whatever the fuck the line was from Twin Peaks. That means nothing.
The owls are not what they appear.
The owls are not what they appear. Thank you. It's like, oh, it's like, yeah, he's going to put the connection. It's like, no. And then he's like, he wakes up in the morning and he sees himself in the mirror, like the scene at the end of Twin Peaks season 2. He's like, this is it. This is where he remembers. It's like, no. And then the best one is that he's at the dinner and, like, all this, the scene of him at the dinner with the fucking tie on his head and eating pancakes and all this stuff is so great.
And the kid just thinking his dad is being fun.
Yeah.
You know?
And then the Naomi Watts puts the coffee, like, here's your coffee. Coffee! And he gets the coffee, takes a sip of the coffee, and you think, like, this is it. This is, yeah, like, Dale Cooper, if there's one thing anyone knows about Dale Cooper is that he likes a damn fine cup of coffee. He takes a sip of the coffee, it's too hot, and he spits it out. And that's, like, the last you see of him in that episode, and then it cuts to the FBI stuff. It's like, so good. It's so good that there's, like, a dozen of these just, like, little things. It's like, oh, it's finally this one. And then it leads to absolutely nothing. It doesn't even feel like it's building up that, like, each time it happens, he comes back a little bit more. It's like, no, he just goes back to being as oblivious and vegetative as he was the first time we saw him, basically.
Yep. That, it really is like, we could play the prediction game of where is this going to go?
Yeah.
And I think that's a useless game to play right now. But it is so interesting to, like, think, by the end of that fourth episode, I had so let go of, like,
yeah,
I'm waiting for this or I'm waiting for this. I'm just taking the ride, and so far, I couldn't be any happier. I don't want to get off, you know?
Yeah, me too.
Because, I mean, and there are clues being laid down. Because, like, when Dougie Jones gets sucked into the Red Room and starts to shrink, he has that ring on from Firewalk with Me, and he turns into this little orb. And then there's a scene later where Mike talks to Vegetative Cooper from the Red Room about it and says, you've been tricked.
Yeah.
So something's going on. I don't know which of those things are red herrings and which things are going to actually matter, because I also think it is very possible he's seen all the criticism about, like, the ring in Firewalk with Me and is trolling people with it again.
Yeah.
Because, again, I think that movie gets way too much literal criticism from that ring, but we'll see.
Yeah.
It's great.
It's really amazing.
Okay, so we've done 4 episodes.
Yes.
We have to wait 2 weeks for more. It's sad.
Yes.
But, you know, I'm going to watch them all again before then, I think.
Absolutely, yeah. At least episode 3 and 4. I might, like, skip through bits of the premiere because it's a lock. That's a lot of TV to rewatch that soon.
It is, but I'll tell you, I want to rewatch 1 and 2 because I don't think I fully appreciated them in the moment.
Sure, yeah.
You know, because I think it took me a while to get into that. But I do, like, it's so great. And then we're going to have, in 2 weeks, we'll have one every Sunday night. I think we're going to talk about them on the podcast.
Yeah. I think it's just unavoidable, probably.
It's just, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's going to be so much fun. And we have, I think they're airing the last 2 together, but that means we have 13 more weeks of Twin Peaks.
Jesus Christ.
How amazing is this?
This is going to be the most surreal 13 weeks of our lives. Like, it's just, I don't even know what it's going to be like coming out the other side of this.
But, you know, I said this on Twitter today, and it's so true to me. Like, we are in such a golden era of television.
Yeah.
Where there are so many shows that just, by all rights, should not exist. And I think that about The Leftovers on HBO. I think that in some ways about Better Call Saul, which exists because it's a spinoff of a really popular show, but it would not on its own, I think, be commercial enough to be out there.
Right.
And you know, just so many other great TV programs right now, and they exist because we're in this really weird model where everyone is kind of throwing cash around and vying for supremacy. But what it means is that there's all this... There's kind of this pool of money out there for creators to do these amazing artistic things. It's a moment in, I think, American media kind of unlike anything we've ever had in terms of filmed media. The closest you can think of is like the 70s in American cinema, when there was this really interesting convergence for a couple of years where studios were paying for really interesting artistic visions, and that generally doesn't happen a lot anymore. It's happening a lot on TV, and this David Lynch thing feels like the peak of that, where Showtime gave David fucking Lynch a blank check to do 18 hours of TV, gave him Final Cut, let him do whatever the fuck he wanted, and he fucking did it. Nothing like this has ever happened.
Yeah.
I mean, and after his last film was 11 years ago, was the avant-garde movie that, you know, no one saw.
Yeah.
And was shot on a shitty camcorder. You know, like, he has never made a movie that was a commercial hit. He, you know, the last time he had significant financial backing was Dune, and everyone knows how that worked out.
Yes, so it's like, I do know how that worked out. Thank you very much.
Yes. But, like, hey, if they weren't for Dune, we wouldn't have Kyle MacLachlan working with David Lynch.
Exactly.
So, no. But it's like, it is so surreal to me that these things are happening, and I do think this moment will end. I do think there's going to be a point where all these studios are going to say, like, wait, we could just make shitty superhero shows. Let's stop funding the interesting artistic projects. This is going to dissipate, and I want us all to appreciate what an amazing moment in time we are living through.
Yeah, no, it really is remarkable, especially when you, like, think about Twin Peaks is a great example of thinking about what a miracle it is that Twin Peaks Season 1 exists at all, and how inevitable it was that that show just completely imploded in Season 2. Like, it could never have sustained itself in any way. And now we have 18 hours of Twin Peaks, like, all directed and written by, like, the same people. Like, it's, you know, it's all written by David Lynch and Mark Frost. And it's all directed by David Lynch. That's unbelievable.
It's so unbelievable that, again, this is a guy who... And he has said he did not stop making movies because he wanted to stop making movies. He stopped making movies because after Inland Empire, no one was funding his movies. And that we live in a very different era than the one he came up in, and the funding just isn't there.
Yeah.
Even with his weird Polish and French sources. And Showtime steps in, and just because Lynch happens to be associated with something with some brand value, he gets this opportunity to make 18 hours of film. Again, if you add up every other one of his movies, it's like 20 hours. This is one of the most remarkable things I just think ever to happen in either medium, film or TV.
Yeah. I mean, it's something where a couple of days ago, I watched the movie Compulsion, which is a 50s, like, detective drama kind of a movie that's on Netflix, kind of why I watched it. And it has Orson Welles plays one of the main characters at the end. And it's from that era where, you know, it's well post, like, Citizen Kane and stuff. It's, like, post Touch of Evil for Orson Welles. And it was, like, in that period where it's, like, oh, like, he's, like, the only thing Hollywood is interested in with Orson Welles is having him act in relatively small roles in these movies, and then they were only interested in that capacity for him for a little while, for a couple of years, and then it was, like, he just couldn't make anything anymore at all and spent, like, the rest of his life, which is, like, basically most of his life, scrambling around trying to get any funding whatsoever to make, like, something, you know? And then there's all these, like, weird, half-done Orson Welles projects that are in some point of, like, some studios trying to do something with it and stuff. And it just feels like such a blessing that we live in a world where David Lynch, like, didn't have to go that way, you know? That, like, he got to have his brilliant movie career and then also now, like, whatever this is, and get to make 18 hours of television, and, like, what a miracle that is, because we could so easily exist in a world where that never happened and Inland Empire was David Lynch's last work of film, and that was it.
Here's what we could easily live in: a world where Dune was his last film. I mean, and again, people love Dune, I get it.
Yes.
But it's like, it's a miracle that he made more after that.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that kind of thing just makes me think of, like, what about all the people who didn't make it, you know, that we would love to see what they could have given the world. But, you know, we get this here and we should be grateful for it. And from these four episodes, better than I thought it was going to be. Is that?
Like, I had really high expectations because I think both of us, like, went into this, whatever, like, Twin Peaks, whatever. Like, both of us went into this, David Lynch is making 18 hours of whatever this is. Like, that is something you show up for, because David Lynch has never made something bad. Like, you could have mixed feelings about some of his works, but even Dune is fascinating, you know? So, like, no matter what, I was really excited to see this. But, yeah, it has absolutely blown my mind. I just did not expect it to be on this level.
Yeah, so I look forward to continuing to talk about this, about Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Thank God we've wrapped up Persona 5.
I don't know how we would have been able to manage it if Twin Peaks had come out a month earlier.
Oh, God. There's so much TV on right now. Yeah. I'm kind of happy. I'm not happy The Leftovers is done in 2 weeks, but I'm happy my Sunday nights will get a little lighter with TV, because now it's Twin Peaks, The Leftovers, Veep, Last Week Tonight. There's so many good shows on just on Sundays.
Yeah.
I'm going to go home after this podcast, recording on Monday night, and watch Better Call Saul, and the Supergirl finale is tonight. I'm watching a lot of TV.
There you go.
Anyway,
next week on the podcast, we'll talk about Doctor Who and probably something else. I don't know. I'll try to see Alien Covenant. I don't know.
Cossacks are from Poland.
Cossacks are from Poland. Here's the note I want to end this podcast on, Jonathan. Here is the thing that separates David Lynch from literally any other director on the planet. It's not just the scene with all the insanity in the steam room in space. It's that at the end of that scene, Agent Cooper gets sucked through the outlet. It's not just that he gets sucked through the outlet. It's that he gets sucked through the outlet and his fucking shoes don't. And that is who David Lynch is.